Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. If you'll please take your seats. First, on behalf of the Rouge Pack, I'd like to welcome all of you to today's event, which I think, in light of a number of different aspects of the current situation, both inside the United States and globally, will prove to be a most remarkable event. I should begin first by mentioning that certainly in the West, the tradition when someone celebrates a birthday is that they receive gifts. They get gifts for their birthday. But Lyndon LaRouche has never been someone who necessarily goes along with the norm. So that today, which is his birthday, Mr. LaRouche has marked that day by giving a gift to all of us, not only with today's presentation, but also with the release of a new paper, which you will find both on the LaRouche Pack website and on the EIR website. And it is a document which, without any question, if we are fortunate, will determine the direction of human history for the next several generations. Obviously, this is a very critical moment. It was months ago that Lyndon LaRouche declared war on Barack Obama's so-called health care reform, denouncing it as, in fact, a Nazi policy. At that time, nobody thought that there would really be much of a fight around health care reform. And obviously, today, we have a very different view of that, thanks to what was catalyzed by Mr. LaRouche on that fateful day at a seminar very much like this one. But it was much longer ago than that, actually more now than 2 years ago, that Mr. LaRouche made clear that what we were facing in the United States and what we were facing globally was a general breakdown crisis of unprecedented proportions. And today we are seeing the immediate manifestations of that breakdown. But no matter how bad people believe things are at this moment, one of the things that LaRouche has said over the course of the last several broadcasts is that really the eye of the storm has yet to move over land, and that, in fact, we would see the worst of what is to come in late September, early October. And that, in fact, we must come together to discuss what we will do, and we must do it now. The hour is already very late. And it is that which makes up the content of this paper that Mr. LaRouche has just released, which, as I said, is a gift that he has given to all of us. So really, without any further introduction, I'm going to ask you to join me in welcoming Mr. LaRouche and also in wishing him a happy birthday.
Thank you. Well, I can promise you a lot of bad news, which I'm sure you wish to hear. You would also like to hear what the bad news actually is, how many varieties there are running loose today in the jungle out there, and what the chances are for changing this. We are now at the end of things. Tomorrow, the President of the United States, so-called, is going to presumably make an address to a joint session of the Congress, and a joint session may mean a marijuana fest, as far as I understand, because people are going to, it's going to have that kind of effect. There's no competence in this president. There never has been, and there would never intended to be. This president is a joker who was played upon the American people with a lot of drug money behind it, and this it was never intended that he would be competent. He is totally incompetent. He's not a man of intellect. He's a man who's trained to babble, and he's been taught the recipes to babble. He has no comprehension of what he's talking about. And that, however, he is the elected president of the United States. And you cannot have coups at this time because the danger is already, there are too many threats of coup d'etats already around. And the system is set up for overthrows of governments, including the United States government. For example, right now, as you may recall, that when certain interests in London and the United States set up what became known as 9/11 as an operation run between as a Saudi-British operation with cooperation of certain people inside the United States. And that's documented. That's a fact. This thing was funded by a British-Saudi operation in which the ambassador of Saudi Arabia to the United States was a key figure in preparing what became known as 9/11. At the time, there were many indications of what that was, but this was quickly hushed up. And the investigations, even as far as they went, were blocked. Certain facts were blocked out. But the evidence was always there, and all you had to do was to look in the right place. And it's there. It came from an alliance between Saudi Arabia and London, which financed and planned the entire operation, and the Saudi ambassador to the United States at that time was a key figure in setting up the operation. Now, this information was accessible to the incumbent government of the United States at that time, but it was hushed up. And something else which had been intended was done instead. The intention was to destroy this government. How? From the inside. And you had an idiot who was an unreconstructed drug addict, a cocaine freak, who had avoided military service in Vietnam by being co-opted into the Texas Air Guard. The Texas Air Guard didn't want him, but the Bush family forced him upon the Texas Air Guard. This fellow continued his habit, which included cocaine, a serious cocaine habit, and the head of the Texas Air Guard and company shipped this guy out to another state where he was supervised by a couple of military officials to go through drug treatment for cocaine addiction. And he went through a year of training and his cure for cocaine addiction, which didn't work. Right. So we had a coke addict who entered the White House as president of the United States, an unreconstructed coke addict, and who just could not drink alcohol except near beer. And he was nothing. Mean character, a mean little jerk, but no brains to speak of. The father was not too bright either. The brains in the family had been used up by the grandfather, who had been a key man in putting Hitler into power in Germany. And you're dealing with that this kind of process, Anglo-American process, all the way through, still to the present day. So now we have, after two terms of this idiot, under Cheney, we have an Obama administration. And despite the fact that Obama, when he was running as a candidate for president, campaigned against the unitary executive, that nonetheless, he, when he became president, became very quickly an advocate of the unitary executive, which is fascism minus a burning of the Reichstag. In other words, this schnook is put in as president. He fumbled around for a period of time. Then a crisis came. He kissed the British butt. Who owned the people who really owned him. And that's how we got to this unitary executive. We now have signing statements from the President of the United States. We have a unitary executive, which was set up as a reaction to the bombing in New York, especially 9/11. We're set up into a dictatorship in which the Congress no longer has the legislative power to control the presidency. Our system of government has gone to a unitary government under which the Congress is allowed to vote as long as they don't contradict the president. If they do contradict the president, he'll make a signing statement and say, yes, you could have you in the Congress, you voted this way, but I, as President of the United States, think differently, and I'm going to act differently. And we have a dictatorship in the United States, which is in the direction of a Nazi dictatorship, under a president who doesn't have any problem with conscience because he doesn't have any brains. He's trained to talk like a training monkey or something out of a mechanical zoo. And is stumbling along. But he's still the president. Now, we in the United States are smart enough to know we don't make coup d'etat. We don't assassinate our presidents as a way of changing government, though some we have some imported people who do that for us from time to time, as in the case of McKinley, which is a very crucial assassination, or the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, or the assassination of John F. Kennedy. John F. Kennedy, of course, is the watershed for this matter. They killed him. Why? Kennedy had 2 points on which he was hated by the Wall Street crowd and the London crowd. Number one, on the question of the conflict over the steel industry, to defend American industrial power. And he made it stick, and he was going to continue to make it stick. Secondly, he opposed the insistence of the Wall Street crowd on going into a war in Indochina while he was president. And for that, he died. Imported assassins directed from Europe by way of Spain and by way of Mexico did the job. Scooted while somebody came up with a funny story to distract attention from everything. But why was he killed? The obvious reason became obvious in the next period after his death. When President Johnson, as Johnson later admitted, had been so terrified by the fact that these three riflemen who killed the Kennedy president were going to aim it to his neck too, as he said at the end of his term in office. And therefore, when the issue came up of what Kennedy had done under the advice and counsel of former General MacArthur and the support of General Eisenhower, had objected to and opposed any launching of U.S. troops into Indochina. And the policy of MacArthur and Eisenhower, the policy adopted by Kennedy, was no U.S. land war involvement in Asia. That U.S. troops cannot handle warfare in Asia because Asian culture is not like European culture. And you're going to run into a different kind of problem. And it's not the way to deal with it in the first place. Because what you were doing, you were going on the side of British-controlled colonialism, imperialism, against the people of Asia. And if you have a country which is associated with a European standpoint, like the United States, culturally, goes into a war against Asians, what are you going to get in Asia? You're going to get a reflex. And that's what we got. And the British have always handled us nicely by getting us into wars in places like Asia. This is the way the British run the world. The British Empire runs the world through warfare. The same way they got imperial power by inducing the silly nation states of Europe to go to war to each other in the so-called Seven Years' War. And the leading nations of Europe went to war against each other for 7 years, while the British stood on the sidelines and encouraged the process and loved. And then on February in 1763, in a Peace of Paris, the British Empire was declared as the empire of a private company called the British East India Company. And the British East India Company took over what had become the United Kingdom and has run it from that time to its equivalent, the present day. The British East India Company, of course, went into bankruptcy at a later period. There were changes made, as under Victoria and so forth, but the principle remained the same. The British East India Company represented a special kind of empire, which is the only kind of empire we've known in the whole history of European civilization. The empires of European civilization were based on the destruction of Greece through self-destruction in the Peloponnesian War, where the monetary interests centered on Venice went to war against the monetary interests centered on the city of Corinth, the Peloponnesian War. And then later, when not satisfied with that spot of self-destruction, the combined forces of Greece went to war against Syracuse, the third maritime power of the Greek-speaking Mediterranean. And thus a power from Asia, from the Asian tradition, called the Cult of Delphi, went through a process of organizing an empire under its control, which later became, by a special agreement, so arranged, the Roman Empire of Octavian, otherwise known as Caesar Augustus. Now, in all this process, what has run the world as an empire, since these developments in a maritime power, that is, we'd had empires in Asia before, the idea of empire comes from Asia, it does not come from Europe. But it was introduced to Europe by this process, by the Peloponnesian War, that vehicle. And since that time, we have had an empire of a maritime characteristic, that it was originally based on the maritime power of the Mediterranean Sea, and later spread to the Atlantic Ocean. A maritime power which had created a control over the use of money. And the basis of this power was money, the control of money as a form of imperialism. All European imperialism, including British imperialism today, is not based on a landed territory. It's based on an international organization of the control of money. Now, this money is actually controlled by private interests, by individuals who form concerts of private interests, who set up the control of money, its creation and management. And nation states are subsidiary to this international control of money. The British Empire, which evolved out of this process, is nothing but that. It is not an empire of the people of the United Kingdom. It is an empire of an international consortium of these types of interests whose control over money is used by use of the control of money to control nations. The one case in which this was not successful was the formation of the United States. And the United States was actually created, especially from the course of the 17th century on. It was created initially by a colonization in New England, by the Plymouth Colony and then by the Massachusetts Bay Colony. And this was the keystone, the kernel of creating what became the United States. These people who came on the Mayflower or came to the Massachusetts Bay Colony, and they came from various parts of Europe, not just English-speaking, but came into this area, came here because they saw Europe as a hopeless cause, that the corruption of Europe is so bad that they could not solve the problem of Europe there. They had to go across the sea, as had been recommended by a great person, Cardinal Nicholas of Cusa, earlier, to continents across the oceans, to carry the best of civilization across the oceans into new territories to meet new people and to set up a civilization which would be free of the colonialist or imperialist evils of Europe. And that started in Massachusetts in that form. And we had the beginning of a different alternative system of finance called a credit system, which was established in the middle of the 17th century in Massachusetts by a system of scrip, which is later referred to as a paper money system by Benjamin Franklin. And it's the characteristic of the U.S. Federal Constitution. The U.S. Federal Constitution does not condone a monetary system of the type that we have had particularly under the Federal Reserve System, which was an act of treason against the United States in the first place, because it destroyed us as a credit system and made us the subject of an international monetary system rather than a credit system. Our Constitution specifies to this day, and this is crucial for us here today to take into account, our Constitution specifies that we are not a monetary system and we are not the subject of a monetary system. We are a credit system as our Constitution defines it and as the history behind that Constitution defines it. The only authorization for the circulation of money inside the United States or any other respectable nation is an act of the state, not the going of the state to some international private monetary complex to which the state goes into debt. And this issue of debt is crucial. Our debt is out by our will, and it's our debt to ourselves, or by treaty agreements with other countries on nation-to-nation agreements. And that is the principle we must apply if we're going to save civilization now. We've come to a point that the monetary system, or the monetarist system, which is based on international financier interests, not nation states, international financier interests, which call free trade. What does free trade mean? It means free of government supervision. It means free of all government supervision. It means a world planet government by private financier interests operating as a consortium of monetarist interests. So always the issue has been that. It was the issue on the death of Roosevelt. On the 12th of April of 1945, the United States was operating under a credit system. As of April 12th, 1945, the United States post-war policy under Roosevelt was to set up a worldwide credit system, not a monetary system. The United States would organize in cooperation with other nations as treaty agreements, would set up an international credit system using the power which we had mobilized for military purpose of production to use the power of the United States to produce the goods, which would then be the engineer for freeing people from colonialism, freeing them from subjugation, and reorganizing Europe on the basis of an international credit system, which had been the intent and the explicit intent of Franklin Roosevelt at the famous Bretton Woods Conference, where he had rejected Keynes and attacked Keynes and rejected him, knowing that this was the British imperial system of Keynes, and the United States and the people of the world must be freed once and forever from monetary system and have the power of a system of sovereign nation states, which would have partnership with their respective credit systems in cooperation. That was Roosevelt's intention. On the day that Roosevelt died, and his successor, Harry S. Truman, no middle name, S, is an S man, took over, he kissed Churchill's butt, and we did everything pretty much wrong since that point on. We've had patriots who have lurched sometimes in the direction of trying to reestablish the influence of the United States despite the fact of the international monetarist system. Because the international monetarist system places the United States among other nations as the victim of international private interests, not governments, and the control over the idea of money by international private banking interests, not governments. Whereas under the American system, only a sovereign nation state and a partnership among sovereign nation states should be allowed to have such power. And that's the crux of the problem now. Today, for example, in the summer of 2007, on the 27th of July, in premises akin to these today, I set forth a policy to deal with the crisis which was immediately oncoming. I said that we were on the brink of a breakdown of the world system, specifically the U.S. system, and that we had to take certain measures, that our banks were bankrupt, and we had to go through a process of reorganization and bankruptcy by using the power of the federal government to declare bankruptcy, especially in respect to mortgages, that is to freeze all mortgages pertaining to people who occupied the residence which was mortgaged, and to protect the banks, which in many cases were already bankrupt, to protect those banks by a Glass-Steagall standard. If we put this forth in the form of a motion, a proposal, which circulated with wide support throughout the United States, the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act of 2007. If that act had been actually introduced, it was introduced on many levels and supported by many parts of the population and institutions of the United States, including states. If that had done, we wouldn't be in a mess today. Well, what happened? During the course of September of 2007, Barney Frank, who's not the nicest person on the planet, and Chris Dodd, otherwise known as a Dodderer, came to agreement to block the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act, despite the large support it had throughout the United States among popular parts of the state organizations and so forth. Had that act been carried through, we would not be in this mess today. But what happened? Why did Christopher the Dodderer and Barney Frank, and he's frankly something special, why did these guys get the support and become the instruments in the Congress to destroy the United States by blocking this? And what did they do? What they did, which became clear in the following year, 2008, what became clear was the process leading to bailout. What we did, we had the whole Wall Street and similar kinds of international financier operations around the world were at that point bankrupt. That was the key problem here. Instead of putting these things through bankruptcy reorganization, we bailed out the bankers of the world at the expense of the American population. Now today, because of the trillions of dollars of theft by the Bush administration and the President Obama administration, we have a lack of the means to meet the needs of our own population. And we've engaged in both a shutdown over these months since September of 2007. We've engaged in a process of destroying the employment and conditions of life and security of the people of the United States, all for the purpose of the looting of those people, the taking away of their employment, in the service of honoring the artificial debt of a bunch of crooked swindlers associated with Wall Street, with the firm of Goldman Sachs, this is the type of thing we deal with. So what we now have is a particular crisis of this president. This president is a butt kisser for the financial interests internationally. Why is he butt kisser? Because the British Queen called him to be. He has no mind of his own. He's educated to memorize speeches whose content he does not understand, the implications of whose content he has no understanding whatsoever. And he's simply the hired fool who occupies the White House and was selected because he was a fool and is a fool, has remained a fool. What comes out of his mouth makes no sense. This man is not intelligent. He's a trained zoo animal who says things, and has great ambition, and lacking brain power, He has delusions of grandeur and assumes that he's the emperor. And this man has adopted, under encouragement, dictatorial powers of the type associated with what was attempted through 9/11 in the so-called signing statements and what happened in the course of the Iraq War and since. We're now implicitly under a dictatorship. Politically, we're at the last stage before the equivalent of a Reichstagsbrand. We're on the verge of a dictatorship in the United States being pushed very soon. And soon is determined by the fact that at the end of this month and beginning of October, the fiscal year of the United States comes to a close. And these accounts have to be reconciled. And there's no money to reconcile these accounts. There is no source of income to keep the states, who are 48 to 49 of these states, are already officially in bankruptcy. And there's no money from any source to take these states out of bankruptcy. The payments that are not being made will never be paid under Barack Obama. There will never be any improvement in the conditions of life under Barack Obama, because Barack Obama's administration is directed under British direction to maintain the interests of the international financier interests, the monetarist interests, the monetary interests, not the United States. And therefore, Obama comes up with a British proposal for Hitler's, actually a carbon copy of the genocide policy of Adolf Hitler. And it is. And no matter how much the Obama people deny it, they are lying. The policy of Barack Obama is genocide against the people of the United States. That's a fact. And anybody who denies that fact is either kidding themselves or lying. If they're official, they are lying. That is the policy. And that's, these people of the United States, have over 60% of them have smelled that and picked on that as the leading reason for their opposition to the Obama administration. They know the guy is a Nazi. And pasting a toothbrush mustache on the upper lip of Obama, like that of Adolf Hitler, makes it very clear to Americans what this guy is. He's a puppet who is assigned to play the part of an Adolf Hitler in healthcare, because they cannot continue to bail out the thieves who looted this country and robbed it and also care for healthcare. They can't even apply ordinary employment without healthcare. We have one-third, approximately, of the population is actually unemployed, about one-third of which, of course, is not receiving anything in terms of compensation for unemployment. And there are others are running out of 52 weeks of unemployment compensation. So we have about 30% of the population is in destitute conditions who used to work for a living and have no hope. Many of them have given up hope. And as this October approaches, we're entering a period where a catastrophe, a social catastrophe, is about to occur. Why? Because President Obama is determined to bail out the system, even if it means killing Americans by his health care program, a health care program which is a copy of what Adolf Hitler introduced into Germany in 1939. In September, October 39. There's not a single iota of difference between what Hitler did in 1939, 1940, and what Obama is dictating today. Not one bit of difference. Obviously, one minimal condition which ought to be imposed, that every creep that's part of that Obama health care cabal should be thrown out of office immediately. Any official government who says I'm wrong is a liar. He should also be thrown out of government. Because we've got a situation. If we care, as a nation, which represents a people, our population, we cannot have the destruction of the great majority of our people into a hopeless condition. And we're not going to do this to bail out some foreign predator. And the foreign predator is just going to have to do a little bit without. Because the great crisis today, which Obama is not talking about, and will not talk about tomorrow unless I scare him into doing it today, is that we've got to deal with the effects of this mass unemployment. And it's not just mass unemployment. Why are people unemployed? Because they're not producing. They have no opportunity to produce. Our industries have been shut down. Our agriculture is in a state of collapse. It's worse than that. It is something tantamount to treason. This name of this tantamount to treason is called globalization. Do you know what happened to this planet after 1968, after the spring and summer of 1968? It's called globalization. It came in the form of a fascist movement on the campuses which had the most privileged campuses of the United States. And they rose up, they tore off their shirts, waved their sexual organs, took dope, and marched out to live freedom forever. I saw this thing. I saw it at Columbia. It was in the universities in the United States and partly in Europe, which had the upper-class so-called universities, in which there was these concentrations of people who were literal copies of the ancient cult of Dionysius, which is the model for fascism. Mark Rudd and company, like the Weathermen and so forth, were actually a fascist organization bred on the campuses of the most privileged students in the United States, whose incentive for this great uproar was not some good for humanity, but the fact that they were being denied what they thought was their exemption from military service in Vietnam. So it was on those universities where the greatest number of exemptions from draft service in Vietnam were provided. When the war got hot and they needed more troops, and they began to dip into these areas. So if the guy was not serious in the class and didn't keep up the highest grades, he was likely to be snapped up in the draft and shipped across and trained to what to do in Iran, in Vietnam. This was the issue which provoked this fascist movement in the United States, which was typified by the Weatherman organization. And this Weatherman phenomenon then spread during the course of the early 1970s and beyond to become the movement which has taken over the policy shaping top down of many of our leading institutions in the United States today. So now we have the Green Revolution, not the part of producing agriculture, because that also has gone under, but the Green Revolution of being against industry, against production. You've got a human race which depends upon the increase of what's called energy flux density of power sources. We've gone from sunlight to burning shrubs, to burning coal, to burning coke, and so forth, up the scale to nuclear power and approximately thermonuclear fusion. The existence of the human race depends upon going to consistently higher energy flux densities, that is, higher concentrations of power. Today we reach the point that without nuclear fusion, nuclear fission and thermonuclear fusion, we cannot continue to sustain a world population of the present magnitude, let alone an increased magnitude. We cannot maintain the standard of living because what we're doing, on the one hand, which is not bad in a sense, we are looting and using up those resources on which we depend, which are the most richly concentrated. These are larger resources which are the, sort of laid down by dead bodies of animals and plants over many millennia. So now we go to the area where the dead bodies of these creatures repose, where minerals were concentrated by biological processes, which concentrated these minerals, and we extract the minerals there, where they're most richly concentrated because of a biological process. We produce, our industry is based on richer levels of resources. Now, as we draw down those resources, there's still plenty of resources in the planet, but you have to get them. They're not lying at your doorstep. You have to go out and get them. This requires more work. This requires more power. And therefore, you constantly have to go to higher levels of power. So mankind's progress went, essentially, from burning of simple objects, and the distinction of man from apes, as far as archaeology is concerned, is generally a fireplace. We find something that looks humanoid and remains. You wonder if it's human or not. If you can find a sign of a fireplace, or something was burned, as in cooking, or fire spot in that area, you say this thing was human. Because only human beings use fire. So mankind's use of fire has defined the nature of man's economy, our ability to produce, our ability to rise above the level of baboons, as depends upon this principle of using fire. But as we use up some resources, we still have plenty of the same resources, but we have to get it. And to get it requires more power. It requires it to make the productivity, not to lose productivity in getting the resources, we have to increase the power which we apply. So in that way, we have to increase our concentration of power. Now, what has happened? These fascists, like the weathermen type, and there are similar kinds of depraved people around the world, have said, no, we're going back to green. We're going back to, sunlight. Going back to wind power. I mean, they should really not eat those beans, but we should... Instead of realizing that we have to face the reality that mankind is changing the world we live in and should be changing the solar system fairly soon, too. We're changing that. And this requires going to more advanced scientific capabilities for mastering these forces, learning to control these higher energy flux density sources of power, and applying them. And this means we can improve the standard of living of our people. We can also more than overcome the apparent shortages we incur by sticking to a stagnant form of production. So we've gone away from that. We don't teach science in universities anymore, really. Or they teach something called science. But there's no devotion to a mission. Take World War II. We had a devotion to a mission. And therefore, the resources of scientific capability and engineering capability were drawn into a concentrated effort to enable us to produce the weapons by which we could win that war and supply the logistical support to conduct that war successfully. At the end of the war, by this means, we had achieved the greatest concentration of productive power the planet had ever seen. And Roosevelt's intention was that we would use that accumulation of power, which we'd use for military requirements, we simply would convert it to its natural occupation for civilian requirements, for advancement of technology, not wasted on war, but use it for these purposes. Roosevelt's intention was to free the people who had been in colonialized part of the world and help them to develop self-sufficiency and eliminate the British Empire and all other empires from this planet in order to build up a planetary system of relatively sovereign nation-state governments of people, and who hope to establish world peace among republics by finding a common interest among the people of these various republics for cooperation. That was Roosevelt's intention for the United Nations, was to convert a colonialized, imperialistic world into a world of sovereign nation-states, American-style, to give them the option of an American-style sovereign nation-state, and to build a bond among these nations of cooperation and not get suckers for the British game of getting controlling planets by getting people to kill each other in wars which somebody made up for them to fight. That was the point. And this was what has been destroyed. It was taken away from us by Truman on. Truman kissed the butt of Churchill, and that's where the whole process started. And now the world is playing the silly game. We are now going to new wars in various parts of the world on schedule, killing people for some cooked-up reason, and all for the benefit of propagation of the British Empire. Why did we go into Iraq twice? There's no need to go in there. Why did we go into Vietnam? There was no need for us to go there. When I was in military service in Burma, at that time, where I was operating out of Mishanar, we were actually supporting Ho Chi Minh in Indochina against the Japanese. And when the Japanese surrendered to U.S. forces, they took over. The U.S. government had joined with Ho Chi Minh in the liberation of Indochina from colonialism. What did Truman do? Truman gave the British backing of the United States to take the Japanese troops out of the camps and reconquer Indochina until the French could get there to take over. And a British agent of operating with Truman's backing did that. So we reversed our policy for which we'd fought war, and we did it all over the world. We recolonized Africa. We recolonized or partially recolonized other parts of the world. We did not use our potential industrial power to enable these countries through machine tools and other things to begin to develop their own independence, true independence and self-sufficiency. And so what we did, we engaged in organizing British-style perpetual local warfare between so-called traditional rivals. And the British, as they had done in the case of the Seven Years' War back in the 18th century, played this situation so the United States, like a damn fool, would go off to fight one more war and bleed its own people to death and waste our material all for the greater glory of the British Empire. And we're still doing that today. In Afghanistan, what a piece of idiocy that is. It's inconceivable idiocy. Blessed by Obama. It's insanity. And the error is crystal clear. This is insanity. So we get into this kind of situation. Today, obviously, we have to realize that we have been betrayed in a very profound way. That is, with Franklin Roosevelt's success as president and his leadership in World War II, we had opened the gates for a new world free of imperialism, free of these kinds of evils we're suffering today. With the death of Roosevelt on April 12th of 1945 and the inauguration of Truman, who was known good from the beginning, who was a stooge for Winston Churchill, the British Empire and their friends inside the United States, their allies, the same ones who had backed Hitler earlier. Remember, the whole Wall Street crowd had been backers of Adolf Hitler until Pearl Harbor. And Truman was one of them, one of that pack. And so when Roosevelt died, who was the representative of the great achievement of his administrations, Truman moved the British back in, and Wall Street back in, to play their games. Now, we have a very special role in world history as a nation. We were established as a European culture. We were established on the initiative of a great figure from the 15th century, a Cardinal Nicholas of Cusa, who recognized that at that time, that the situation in Europe was becoming hopeless culturally, that the great intentions of the Council of Florence were being sabotaged and were in danger. And he came to the conclusion that people in Europe had to think about going out across the oceans to make contact with other parts of the world and take the best features of European civilization with them to contribute to these continents. And thus, by defending the advances of European civilization in these other continents, would feed back into Europe and tilt the balance so that Europe itself could achieve its own proper intention. There were various efforts in this direction. Christopher Columbus was actually inspired specifically by the program of Nicholas of Cusa, in about 1480 AD, which he actually was able to carry out in his first voyage in 1492. But the Habsburg control of Spain and Portugal meant that the attempt to develop civilization in Central and South America was jeopardized by this influence. And so it was not until the 17th century, in the colonization in Massachusetts in particular, that the initiative occurred for the development of the United States. Our distinction in the world is precisely that, the heritage of that period. Our distinction is we formed on this continent a republic which contained the best representatives of European civilization, people who came here from various parts of Europe, in the leading part, to not to flee from Europe, but to carry European culture into a new continent and develop here a kind of nation state, which would be an example for the restoration of some kind of decency to Europe. And thus we have this distinction between our British cousins, so-called, and ourselves, that for many of us, we are part of the same cultural origin as they are, but their system of government is fundamentally different than ours. And the difference is largely not in language, though there is some difference in the use of language and who we call what and what not. But the difference is essentially this ingredient, that we do not accept the oligarchical conception of society, which is characteristic of Europe. We demand our kind of society, which is based on the nature of the individual. And we represent, in large degree, the best of European culture brought here, but freed of the habit of oligarchism, you know, of kissing the butt of Sir this and Sir that and Baron this and so that and so forth, that sort of thing. We don't believe in this idea of oligarchical social class. And that is the fundamental distinction. So we as a nation, an English-speaking nation by and large, are absolutely unique on the planet. And we are the greatest danger because we represent the autonomy of European culture to the use of European culture in Europe as a way of destroying humanity. That's why they want to destroy us. Now, this comes to the practical question. What are we supposed to do now? The whole debate by Obama. Obama's a liar. And I would call him a liar, really, if he were not an idiot. And how can you call an idiot a liar? I mean, that's really a problem. But his thing about my program or nothing, the guy's a complete fraud. I don't think he thought up the fraud himself because he doesn't think very well. But I think somebody told him that and he's repeating it, being whipped into place. He's saying we have to kill people, kill our citizens, in order because our economy can't afford to feed them. I say, well, Mr. President, you are kind of stupid, aren't you? That's not the problem. The reason we can't feed our population is the fact they aren't employed. You took away their employment. You took away their industries. You took away their agriculture. Why don't you give them back their jobs? Why don't you give them back their industries? Why don't you give them back their farms? Why don't you support their industry? Why don't you support their investment in their industry? Why don't you enforce investment in their farms? Why don't you educate them for the new kinds of employment which are required today, which we could do? Why do you have them out in the streets with no education whatsoever? Why do you have lab school education instead of real education? These young guys coming out of school don't know anything. Why? Because they've been educated to be know-nothing. Why don't we go to the mission of where are the jobs? Hey, Mr. President, where are the jobs? Hey, Mr. President, where are the skills for those jobs? Hey, Mr. President, where are the industries to employ these people? Hey, Mr. President, where are the farmers, the prosperous farmers we used to have to employ these people? Where's the basic economic infrastructure to change the power of mankind, increase the power of mankind in this universe, Mr. President? You've got these people out there, the citizens. You want to kill them. You want to increase the death rate among them. You say there are too many. You say we want slaves, not educated people. Why, Mr. President? Why are you such an idiot? Why do you insist that if we don't listen to you, we're not going to make it? If we listen to you, we surely will not make it, Mr. President. Now, Mr. President, I'm willing to keep you in the presidency for one reason, because you were elected. I may regret that deeply, but that's a fact of the matter. I regret the fact that you're president because you're too stupid to be president. But, Mr. President, I have a solution for you. I'll take care of this problem for you. You sit in the Oval Office with a group of advisors. Get rid of this bunch of clowns that you've got that's pushing this genocide. You've got some perfectly fine, qualified people in your administration. Just get rid of the bumps. And I'm afraid Rahm has to go. Rahm and his brother should go out and try to find what happened to the toilet lid in the King David Hotel when his father blew up that hotel. And there was a British colonel exposed naked to the world because the structure had crumbled around him because of this lousy bombing job done by the Obama, the Emanuel family. And there he is. The plumbing is holding up this bathtub. The colonel is naked in the bathtub, exposed to all kinds of ridicule because of his British proportions and characteristics. But where's the toilet lid? What happened to the toilet lid? I think, Rahm, you and your brother ought to go out and find that toilet lid. Or at least give us a decent report what happened to it. We don't need the Emanuel family in our government. We don't need Orszag. We don't need a lot of others. But particularly, we don't need anybody who's associated with this health care policy of this president. They must go. And they must go suddenly. Now, your problem, Mr. President, is now to pay attention to what I can do and some other people can do to advise your government. You will sit safely protected in the Oval Office because I don't want anybody to harm you in any way. We're going to protect you against your former British friends who will want to kill you over this issue. We're going to protect you. The full resources of the United States are going to protect your person as president. You will sit safely in the Oval Office by every means we can use to accomplish that. Don't worry about that. We'll treat you in a very friendly, kindly, respectful way. We will not have you announce any policy that you have not been presented with. You will simply say, you don't have to understand the policy, you can simply say, I accept the guidance of my friends here. On that basis, we have people in the wings of government, outside government, who, to my knowledge, are willing to step forward, replace that bunch of clowns associated with the Obama health care policy and similar kinds of things, and put together a program for doing what? The first thing we have to do is we've got an immediate situation coming up in the month of October, November, beyond. An absolutely desperate situation for people who are running out of, in vast numbers, the last shred of unemployment insurance. The last shred of support for the means of existence. Facing a disease, an epidemic disease, which is highly dangerous, when the Obama administration is trying to destroy all the very means we require to deal with epidemic disease. We're dealing with a demoralization of the U.S. population, which is losing confidence in itself and confidence in the future. This is what we have to concentrate on. We have to create real employment. Not real employment in make work, but real employment in some kind of production work, the way Roosevelt did in the Depression years, in the beginning. We have to put people back to work. We don't have the work for them. Yes, we have to provide unemployment compensation to keep them alive and keep them in condition.
and keep their dignity above all. We've got to save communities which are no longer productive. Put them back into productivity. We're going to concentrate largely on basic economic infrastructure, physical infrastructure of a type that's necessary for the foundation of industry. Now, when you build large-scale infrastructure programs, you also create a lot of private employment. Because when you have a major contract, a government contract, for building a piece of infrastructure, what do? You call in private firms as bidders on contracts to service the completion of this work. In that way, wherever you put in, like a transportation project, for example, or some other project which is a government project, you immediately stimulate employment of this type in the vicinity. People who have skills, who have small businesses or something of that kind of skill, who can bid on the job and do the job. And we've got to do that fast. The first thing we have to do is to do enough of it to convince the people out there that that's what we intend to do. You know? Once they can, we go think back to the experience as I saw it and others saw it back in the 1930s. The first thing to do, you've got to rebuild the confidence of those people out there who are feeling desperate in themselves. You've got to rebuild confidence in those communities which are affected by the desolation which is being caused now. You've got to create productive employment, Mr. President. Not green employment, productive employment. You have to fix up the Ohio River, which is no longer functioning because of neglect. You've got to fix up the Mississippi River. You've got to build up the Missouri River. You've got to build up the Oglala Aquifer in the West if you want agriculture for the future. There are many things to do. Get cracking at it. Pick a few of these projects. Get them started. Correlate the way you start these projects with the way you locate revitalization of employment in industries and local communities, as we used to do. Look at a map of the United States. Go state by state. Cooperate with the state officials. Map the problem. Decide where you need the social effect of employment. And find the form of employment that fits the program and make sure they get a share of it there. We want to have an increase by about 20% of employment of the people of the United States who over the immediate period ahead. We want them to feel that is a Christmas present and a New Year's greeting for a change in the way things are going. The American people are trusting, and if you show respect for them and respect for their needs and a sense of justice, they will trust you for a certain period of time. And they're now in a mood. We're in a mass strike mode in this country, Mr. President. And the country doesn't like you, Mr. President. And matter of fact, they're coming to hate you, Mr. President. They're not going to do violence to you, but they hate you nonetheless. You are a symbol of the suffering you've imposed upon them. And you've got to prove that you're a better man than that. And we'll help you succeed if you consent to do that. We'll keep you in the White House. You'll stay there. You'll be protected. You will be consulted on every question that comes up that you should be consulted on. But you're going to listen to your advisors. And the advisors are going to be a lot more competent than you are. And you're going to learn a lot. For the first time in your life, you're going to really learn a lot that you need to know. And you will walk out of that job with the pride that while you were president, whether you were qualified to be president or not, that under your presidency, the job was done. And you can take pride in that. That's what I can give you. It's the best I can give you. Junk your present program. It's idiotic, it's completely stupid, and it's criminal. Stop it. Mr. President, for the first time in your life, be a mensch. Okay.
My foot fell asleep.
Okay, well, let me first begin by saying that for those of you who have participated in these events before, you know something of the format. We have a number of questions that have come in from around the world. Those questions will take precedent. If people here have questions, you can either ask the question yourself or you can write your question out and I will ask it. In either case, though, you have to indicate who you are. If you want me to read the question, you have to write it out. If you want to ask the question yourself, that's fine, but you have to indicate to me the nature of your question. And there's Pat, who has index cards for you. And while people are getting to that, let me just say that, well, we have greetings that have come in for Lynn, wishing him a happy birthday from all over the world. I really can't even begin to read all of them. Let me just say that, just in indicating that among the places that these greetings did come from are China, Russia, Argentina, Australia, actually other countries in Latin America as well, Mexico, Peru, Bolivia, Venezuela, Panama, etc., and certainly from various people here in the U.S. So happy birthday from everybody, Lynn. We also have, obviously, satellite meetings going on all over the world. I don't have time to read all of them. I understand that for the first time, we have a group participating from Mauritius, and I'd like to welcome them, certainly. But now I really think that we do have to get to the large number of questions that have come in. The bulk of the questions do come from various institutions inside the United States who are working on precisely the questions that Mr. LaRouche has addressed in the body of his remarks. In some cases, it is clearly the case that the questioner or the institution question knows the answer to what they're asking, but I think they simply want Mr. LaRouche on record for obvious reasons. And I think that will become clear to people as we proceed. First, there are a few questions that have come in from international institutions, and I'd like to ask those questions first before we get into really the meat, if you will, of some of these other questions. And the first few questions actually come from China, from a major think tank in China that has been following Lynn very closely. The question is prefaced by a request to forward to Lynn good wishes on his 88th birthday and to wish him many happy returns of this day. The questioner notes that 8, as a number in China, symbolizes luck, and we are sure going to need it. His question is, he says, Mr. LaRouche, as you know, China holds more than $2 trillion in foreign currency. This has led to a great debate about the dollar as a reserve currency, et cetera, et cetera. But really what I wish to ask you is if you think that such a practice of holding such a large sum of money in foreign currency, is a safe practice And if not, what you would indicate as a more reliable option for nations?
The greatest asset we should seek at this moment of world history is the establishment of a relationship among a group of sovereign nation states, which can be considered keystone sovereign nation states, which represent sufficient power to force the world as a whole to come to its senses. Now, what I've indicated, there are four nations which are most obvious candidates for that. Our own United States, presumably under a President Obama who has accepted my proposals today. Otherwise, we got a problem. Secondly, Russia, which is not only a major Eurasian state, but which has the keystone in technology, not just in territory, but in technology, and historically developed technology, to develop the mineral resources of the tundra and related areas of Siberia and northern Russia. Because these things, these resources are the richest resources now available, apart from what's in the ocean. The ocean is the basic source of all mineral resources of mankind today. But this is key, particularly in respect to China's proximity to Asia. Because South Asia and Central Asia, such as China, requires a very large increase of the dollars of productivity of its population. The problem of China today, for this sudden collapse of the U.S. and other markets, which has occurred, is that there's a large part of the Chinese population and territory which has not been sufficiently developed to have any sort of autonomy in terms of its position in the world economy. And therefore, that has to be fixed. Despite the changes in government in Japan, the interest of Japan is clearly remains the technology of Japan and its participation in a role in respect to cooperation with China, in cooperation with Russia, and in that region. Because the development of Siberia, particularly of the Pacific section of Siberia, is very crucial for this entire area. So therefore, then you have to have the next largest nation in the world, India, China and India, and the United States and Russia. These four nations, not excluding others, represent a crucial combination of nation states which, if in cooperation with this kind of intention that I've indicated, is the basis for a change in the world system. I think without such cooperation, the possibility of saving the world from a new dark age is highly questionable. The role of these nations is crucial, their cooperation. We have to understand, of course, that there are differences in policy and culture among these nations, but that is not important because this is a part of the problem. We do not need a homogenized world. One of the great problems today, which I did not reference, but I think I should reference it here, is globalization. The reason for the danger we face today is a process which was actually launched in 1968, but especially over the period 68-73, a process leading to globalization. We destroyed the functioning concept of the sovereign nation state. Today, we shipped production from nations which had high technology into nations which did not have high technology and used cheap labor as the offset for the difference in productivity in those nations. Thus, we destroyed the technological capability of higher level of technological capability in the United States, Germany, and so forth, and shipped production into other parts of the world. The effect has been that the idea of national economic security no longer exists on this planet at this time. Nations do not have any degree of self-sufficiency. We used to have a degree of self-sufficiency in basic food supplies, in basic industrial requirements, and so forth. we no longer have that as a result of globalization. Worse, the policy of the international system today has been to shift production from nations which do not consume that production to nations which will not produce that but will consume it. So therefore, the international monetarist money men are able thus to control both nations because they control the food supply of one and the industrial production of the other, that sort of thing. You no longer have sovereign nation states in the economic sense. Therefore, for this reason, the collapse of the United States or the internal collapse of China because of this loss of employment, which has recently occurred, would be sufficient to blow the whole planet up into a dark age as a chain reaction effect. There are no nations which could survive a collapse of the U.S. economy today. The collapse of the U.S. economy would mean a total collapse of the world as a whole in a chain reaction effect in a very short period of time. And China is the leading target for this right now. Always, if the United States goes down, China goes down. If China goes down, Russia goes down. Europe goes down. South and Central America become a joke, but a bad joke. So therefore, if we do not end globalization, if we do not enter into a system of cooperation among sovereign nation states to end globalization by reversing this process, then there's no chance of civilization on this planet for generations still to come. The question of the $2 trillion debt to China is exemplary of this. China has no external markets to make up for that. And if the credit of the United States is no good, then China has to eat those $2 trillion and lose everything that goes with it. That sets off quite a time bomb inside the United States itself, as well as China, and the world as a whole. So therefore, we can no longer stand for globalization. Monsanto will give up this fake patent rights it has. No one will be allowed to patent a food. They didn't invent it. They can't patent it. Let Monsanto, get them out there. Okay, Mr. Monsanto, you can have all the inorganic ingredients you want. You cannot have any living thing in there. And I want you to show that you can take these inorganic elements and combine them in such a way that suddenly you have produced grain, viable living grain, that can hatch and produce more grain. If you can't do that, Mr. Monsanto, I think we have to consider your patent rights a fraud and they're canceled. This is the kind of problem we face. Now, what we have to do to deal with this, you really have to have some competent economics of this. We need a 50-year contract, essentially, among the leading nations of the world, which will be a credit system shared among the nations of the world. Each will have their own credit system, but we'll have them in a fixed exchange rate relationship. We will then make agreements between governments which allow for investment in long-term cooperation. Now, take the case of China, which is the specific question here. China cannot put its entire population on the world market for export today. It won't work. The market isn't there. The market has been destroyed. It was artificial anyway. What China requires is a long-term capital development of its own internal technology. That means capital investments over a period of about 50 years. 50 years mean. So therefore, you have to have an international system, a fixed exchange rate system, based on long-term credit for these kinds of projects, which will enable China, for example, to develop its capabilities to enter in with full partnership and full equality on the world market. for its entire population, which is going to increase. And to maintain an increasing population on this planet today requires a very rapid and very aggressive bit of technological progress, scientific and technological progress. So science, China must have a participation in that part of scientific and technological progress, which enables it to catch up, so to speak, of its whole population, to catch up to international standards. And within 50 years, that's about two generations, we can do that. So China requires a system of international credit at reasonable rates. We're talking about 1.5% to 1% internationally, under agreements between sovereign nation states, which have the purpose of ensuring that every nation state is going to come to a point 50 years from now where the system is more or less in balance as nation states. And we have to eliminate globalization to do that. No more globalization. Cancel it. Go back to the sovereign nation state. And that's what China has to be a key part, precisely because China has this problem. And because China, at the same time, is a very important part of any international combination of change. Therefore, the rights of China, the interests of China, must be served in any such agreement. Without such an agreement, there's no chance for the world as a whole. China, India, Russia, the United States. Because Europe presently has no function on a world scale. Because the British have gobbled up Europe with the euro. There is no sovereign nation in between the Atlantic Ocean and the Russian border to speak of. Doesn't exist. They've all been gobbled up by by the euro. And therefore, we have to restore sovereignty of nation states in Europe in order to qualify them to be free to participate fully in this type of reorganization. In the meantime, my view, the United States, Russia, and China, and India. These are four nations which have differences in cultural outlook, differences in perspective, but have a common interest to unite around the common interest as a sovereign nation state and to create a nucleus to overpower the British Empire in the world.
I know I said I was going to ask these international questions first, but I'm going to have to. I basically lied. I'm going to have to make some changes. I will try to get to all of these questions. I'm going to ask one or two more of them, but we're being deluged with questions from various U.S. institutions, and I really do want to try to get to them. Lynn, this question comes from a Russian diplomat in New York, and the question relates to the U.N. Conference on Trade and Development, which over the last few days has released a report in which they say that the system of currencies and capital rules that currently bind the international financial system is not working properly, and according to them, is what was largely responsible for the current financial and economic crises that we face globally. The UN, in their report, adds that the present system under which the dollar acts as the world's reserve currency should be subjected to wholesale reconsideration. The questionist says that although a number of countries, or at least leading economists in a number of countries, including China and Russia at various points, have suggested replacing the dollar as the world's currency, the UN report is the first time, to his knowledge, that a major multinational institution has posed this kind of suggestion. He says that, in essence, what the report calls for is a new Bretton Woods-style system, of managed international exchange rates, meaning that central banks would be forced to intervene and either support or push down their currencies, depending on how the rest of the world economy is behaving. The UN proposal also implies that surplus nations such as China and Germany should stimulate their economies further in order to cut their own imbalances rather than, as in the present system, deficit nations such as the UK and US having to take the main burden of readjustment. He quotes one of the authors of the report who says, replacing the dollar with an artificial currency would solve some of the problems related to the potential of countries running large deficits and would help stability. But you will also need a system of managed exchange rates. Countries should keep real exchange rates adjusted for inflation stable. Central banks would have to intervene, and if not, they would have to be told to do so by some multilateral institutions such as the IMF. He says, Mr. LaRouche, these proposals, to me, amount to a threat to national sovereignty and perhaps the most radical suggestions for redesign of the global monetary system that I have seen to date. Although many economists have pointed out that the economic crises that we currently face owe more to the malfunctioning of the post-Bretton Woods system, it still seems to me that this proposal is not a very good alternative. I ask you the question, however, because I know that this will come up as a major discussion as an alternative at the G20 meeting, and also because I know that this has been a source of massive debate, often very hostile debate, in my own country.
Well, the point is the whole issue is totally incompetent. The problem is, we have been going, the world as a whole, beginning with the United States in, 65. The United States went to zero growth, net zero economic growth in basic economic infrastructure. Since about 1968, 1973, the United States has been in a process of negative growth. Since the same period, 1967, 1973, Europe has been in a state of negative growth and real decadence. This negative growth has been a result of policies adopted by governments and adopted and encouraged by leading economists working inside those countries or for those governments. So I think it's free to say that the thinking of the UN, as described by the questioner, the thinking of the UN is a reflection of that habit of incompetence which has led to the present world crisis. And I don't think we need more of that incompetence as a stimulus for remedies. We don't need more injections with the disease which has caused the problem. And the problem has been caused by the incompetence of the economic policies of virtually every leading government of the world, in one way or the other. China, for example, China has progressed, but China progressed on the assumption of being an exporter for other countries. That export market for China has disappeared. China's policy depended upon the assumption that that would not take Russia. Russia's policy was a stupid one, in a sense. Despite what was accomplished by President Putin and then by President Medvedev. It's been foolish. Why? Because it based Russia's future on the gamble that the raw material sale from Russia to other countries would be the source of income from Russian growth. And now that market has collapsed. and Russia's in a crisis because it had the wrong policy of assuming certain things about the rest of the world's policies which are wrong. So I can take the case and prove it, and I have proven it, I think, repeatedly, that the policies of every part of the world have been aggregately insane in terms of their long-term effects over the past 40 years. We're in a mess today because of 40 years of wrong thinking. And then you got the economists come up and say, well, we're the expert. We're going to fix this for you. We're going to tell you how to fix it. They say, please, I had cancer once. Don't give it to me again. I don't need that anymore. And that's where the problem is. Now, what? There's only one thing. First of all, you've got to do, you must eliminate monetarism. You must use the United States as the proven standard under certain presidents, under its original intention of certain presidents, such as Lincoln, such as Franklin Roosevelt, and use those experiences to show the American system was the best system that was ever developed for economy on this planet. Except we had a problem. We had too much British influence inside Wall Street. And it was British influence and British traders inside the United States who loved the British Queen more than they loved their own country, which are the cause of our problems. Apart from the fact that Britain was an empire, we had trouble fighting against it for some period. But we defeated the British Empire under Lincoln. Palmerston went down, you know, like a rocket. But what happened is that Lincoln was shot by the British. It was the British who killed him. This is an open fact. No question about that. Just like McKinley was assassinated. For example, McKinley. McKinley was a patriot, a seasoned patriot, and a competent president of the United States. But they got into trouble, and he put a bum in his vice president, Teddy Roosevelt. Teddy Roosevelt was the nephew of the chief Confederate spy working for the British Empire in the Civil War. Teddy Roosevelt was essentially a traitor to the United States. Now, at that point, under McKinley, the policy of the United States in terms of Europe was to try to make peace with France, which was a difficult problem at that time, and to rely upon the tradition of Bismarck's role in Germany and to try to have relations with Russia, which are based on Bismarck's agreements with the Russian Tsar. That was our policy of war avoidance. We were going to cooperate with Germany and Russia and hopefully France against the British Empire. That was our policy. The assassination of McKinley by a British agent sent in from Europe to do the job with cooperation of the circles of Theodore Roosevelt in New York City, who was then the Vice President of the United States, brought President Theodore Roosevelt into power and a fundamental change in policy. It was Theodore Roosevelt's inauguration as president in cooperation with what became the Woodrow Wilson administration, which installed the Federal Reserve System, which is the enemy of the U.S. Constitution. It was these arrangements that put the United States into its role in World War I, and despite the British, Franklin Roosevelt changed it. It was supposed to go the other way. Franklin Roosevelt was supposed to be on the side of the British in this thing, and he wasn't. He was on the side of the United States. And then when Roosevelt was out of office, they used Truman, who was a pig, to put us back in the same direction again. And over the entire period, the leading economists, with some exceptions in the United States, were traitors to the United States in terms of their way of thinking. Or either traitors or incompetent. Most of the economists I know, I know some economists who are competent in varying degrees. Some of them are incompetent in specialties. Some are competent in history. Some are incompetent in certain aspects of national policy making. There are some of these people who I would obviously say should be called into it as key advisors of the present U.S. government because they have the kind of knowledge which is needed to provide the government with a well-crafted policy, a foreign policy, economic policy, domestic policy. They exist. But in general, the leading theme of what is accepted on Wall Street and by the national press, the national news media, as economic policy has been clinically insane and even criminal. And it's those insane or variously criminal policies and misguidance which has led the nations of the world into this process, this mess, and especially the mess of the past 40-odd years. And we need no more from them on their way of thinking. We have to eliminate monetarism. We have to destroy, through bankruptcy reorganization, like an international Glass-Steagall Act, we have to purge the world of everything that smells of monetarism and rely only on sovereign nation states' lawful currency. We must bring into agreement to a global fixed exchange rate system. The way to do that is the dollar, because the dollar has no longer, since about 1973, has no longer been a controlling factor in international monetary affairs. The British Empire has been the controlling factor in international affairs. Eliminate the British Empire, and you suddenly find a different world. This all the filth in the world, all the evil, comes from the British Empire, which, as I said today, is not an empire of the people of the United Kingdom. It's an empire of an international monetarist interest. This monetarist interest is, by its nature, private, not public. The World International Monetary Fund is essentially a cabal of private interests, not nation interests. But the nations have been corrupted by monetarism. We must eliminate monetarism from this planet. All the agreements on reform of the international system have been failures from the outset by design, because they assume that we're going to have agreements among monetary systems, like those of John Maynard Keynes. And don't forget that in 1936, when John Maynard Keynes published his general theory, he published it first in Germany. And he selected Germany as the source of the place of its publication because he thought the policies of the present policies of Germany were more suitable to his policies than those of any other part of the world. In other words, Keynes was really a fascist. And the world has been influenced largely in the post-war world by the influence of John Maynard Keynes. And Keynesianism is one of the worst diseases on this planet. Eliminate monetarism. Go back to credit systems, fixed exchange rate credit systems of each nation of the world, and start with four nations which have to get rid of that pestilence right away: the United States, Russia, China, and India. And other countries will happily join that alliance. But the UN is largely a bad institution for that, because it's polluted by this kind of monetarist and similar kinds of liberal thinking. The very kind of thinking that brought us to this crisis since the day that Roosevelt died, and especially since the 1968, when fascism ran amok in the streets of the United States in the name of the Weberman, which was a cultural change which became the baby boomer movement, which destroyed the United States from the inside. And that's where we have to look at these things.
Lynn, this is a question along a similar vein, which came up from the question itself came from a combination of the Stanford group, but it was the Stanford group actually discussing a report that came out of a conference that was held in June in Paris by a number of economists, most of them American, but some of them representing other countries as well, which included the American economist Jamie Galbraith. This is the Economist for Peace and Security, as well as the Initiative for Rethinking the Economy. And the question is as follows. See, Mr. LaRouche, without question, the growing assessment of all of us, but also of economists all over the world, is that the IMF is essentially beyond repair. The organization exists outside the framework of law, and it routinely violates its own charter with impunity, particularly in denying to member states the right to impose control over capital flows. As I think you know, under the charter of the IMF, members do have the right to demand reduction in terms of repayment. Yet, the IMF and the World Bank routinely seek to set themselves apart as creditors preferred above anyone else. Conditionality and austerity are imposed on the most vulnerable member countries with the objective of undermining the most basic human economic rights under conditions that preclude any possibility of effective economic recovery. I think we can all agree that adding funds and power to this organization is an exercise in self-defeat. In fact, the very concept of a reformed IMF is an oxymoron. However, they say, while there really is no question that in an ideal world, what you've called a four-power agreement to replace the currently dysfunctional international monetary institutions would certainly be the most preferable option. However, there does not really seem to be an immediate appetite for this. One proposal that has been put before us as an alternative to a single reserve asset world is something that we wanted your opinion on because there's some lack of clarity among us. And certainly this is different than the market basket of currencies that has been proposed elsewhere, but we are not sure this is workable. What we have been handed is an alternative to a single reserve asset system that would pursue the development of regional monetary authorities, which could, among other things, make dollar reserve assets earned by countries that are successful net exporters available to neighbors who are not. Such authorities would have distinct advantages over a global system because, one, the regional fund has a direct stake in the success of the other member countries under its authority, and, two, a structured system like this would give small countries some of the advantages and margin for maneuver that are now enjoyed by large countries in both the developed and developing world. And three, regional power can be deployed effectively over regional financial institutions. The drawback of this is, I think, clear, but is there anything salvageable, as far as you can see, in this proposal, especially as an interim measure to be taken?
What you have to look at is you have to look at the Glass-Steagall Act by President Franklin Roosevelt, which was Larry Summers from inside the Clinton administration when Clinton was in trouble, managed to screw up. You have to have, the first step in dealing with any monetary question today, or any question of currency, you must put every system of the planet through internal bankruptcy reorganization. This planet has been polluted. All the financial transactions included by this process of which began, really was unleashed in 1987, with the 1987 crash, under which, in effect, the Greenspan unleashed hell on earth in the form of financial derivatives. It's a swindle. Now, most of the debt and most of the listed assets which are under discussion in most parts of the world today are completely fraudulent. If you apply a Glass-Steagall standard, which you must apply because it's the one existing standard which is reliable for all countries, every country in the world can apply that standard the same way. You apply the Glass-Steagall standard and you take this pile of so-called monetary assets, financial assets over here. Put a big pile here. Now you put a test. It's like you're going to heaven or you're going to hell. And at the gates, you've got St. Peter is watching at the gate. Somebody comes up and says, we have this financial asset. He says, downstairs, please. And by the time you've gone through the process, there are very few saved Christians or anybody else left up there. So you have a much smaller number of claims, of financial claims on the system as a whole. You have eliminated the waste material. You've had the great Ex-Lex event of the century. And therefore, we should not talk about the existing so-called national monetary assets, because they're polluted. We have to cancel most of them. You know, I think about $25 to $30 trillion of the debt listed as the assets and claims of the United States ought to be just gone. Now we've got to go back to a hard credit dollar. We have to transform the U.S. dollar from a monetarist dollar to a hard credit dollar, which means that suddenly agriculture and industry and other things become the means anymore, no longer financial speculation. Financial speculation is a crime. I think we ought to make that as a part of our, you know, criminal law. The practice of monetarism should be outlawed as a crime against humanity. Certainly, monetarism has killed more people on this planet than any known disease. Shouldn't we outlaw it? Its only rival is drug trafficking. Shouldn't we outlaw it? So therefore, when we talk about a relation among national currencies, we mean the currency of a national credit system, in which a sovereign government declares, this is our money. It's not somebody else's money. It's not some international cartel. Governments don't borrow money from international financial institutions. It's a matter of their relationship with an institution, their sovereign relationship to any private institution. It's not a matter of international institutions. What has killed the world since the time of ancient Greece, since the Peloponnesian War, what was the problem? Was it an economic problem? No, it wasn't. It was a monetary problem. The question was, you had, after the defeat of the Persian Empire's attempt to take over the Eastern Mediterranean, after the great battle where this occurred, you had three foci of Greeks, what we call today Greek, Greek-speaking culture in the Mediterranean, which had a certain relationship with Egypt, which unfortunately at that time was under Persian occupation. And Egypt was an essential part of the culture. The relationship of Greece, historical relationship of Greece to the culture of the Greek culture and the Etruscan culture, for example, were a key part from the 7th century B.C. onward. So you had suddenly the Persian Empire had attempted to take over the area of the Eastern Mediterranean and beyond, using its alliance with Tyre as a key part of this process. And so this whole period through the triumph of Alexander the Great is of this particular type of nature, where Egypt came back into the situation as an independent power, Tyre was destroyed, and the Persian Empire was gobbled up by Alexander, who tried to assimilate it into a new kind of international system. He was poisoned, probably by Aristotle, who had tried to poison him before, but this time probably successfully. But so this is the period. So what had happened is, in this period, before Alexander's defense, you had these Greek influences, which were, apart from being political influences, were actually economic interests. The economic interests of maritime power, Greek civilization, and also predominantly, historically, Egyptian civilization, the Etruscan civilization, was essentially maritime power, not land power. And thus, these nations, which had emerged in the melting of the glaciers and up to the present levels of seas today, these powers had existed on the basis of trade. They produced things and they traded. The trade was based on the existence of monetary systems. The monetary system of reference for the Greek-speaking people of that period was the cult of Delphi, which was an Asian intrusion into European civilization. And the priests of the cult of Delphi, playing their magic tricks and so forth, got these three parts. One centered on Athens, another centered on Corinth, which is the Sparta area, the other centered on Syracuse. And they started out with a war between the two Greek-speaking areas, which were rivals in trade on the basis of monetary rivals, who was going to be the monetary power. So they got into a war, the beginning of the Peloponnesian War, the first phase, which is Athens against Corinth, the Athenians, the Ionians against this Peloponnesian War. Then, not satisfied with that piece of folly, which had almost destroyed the joint, they went to a war with Syracuse and did the same thing. Another great power in the Mediterranean. Syracuse was the center of intellectual and monetary financial power and economic power in that region. Boom. So they destroyed themselves for the sake of another power. So you had systems of monetarism, which private ownership of money or the equivalent of money were determined power. And the wars of the world, particularly of European civilization, since that time to the present day, have been a struggle for imperial power of
states. Imperial power above nation states. That's what the meaning of empire is. Empire is not, the British Empire is not an empire because the British control the world. If you know British people, they're not capable of controlling the world. They can't even control themselves.
But they can control some stupid Americans. But the power lies in the power of a private interest, a private monetary interest, a money interest, which by controlling money and credit based on the idea of money, control nations as from above. This is what imperialism is in the European experience. It's monetarism, like that of John Maynard Keynes. It's monetarism. And that's where the problem lies. When we get rid of monetarism by going from, as our American founders understood, from the time of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, get rid of monetarism. Get rid of the international imperial power of private monetary interests over nation states. Establish the superiority of the sovereignty of the nation state over all other power. And define world relations on the relations between among sovereign nation states, like the U.S. Constitution prescribes. This is our unique genius, and our system is a Hamiltonian feature of the U.S. Constitution. And thus, if you want to have a reform, the first thing you do is you take the monetarists out and melt them down, because they're not real. Because that's what you've got to do. So don't talk about relations, about state-to-state relation or system-to-system relation. You've got to get rid of syphilis first. Get rid of the syphilis before you try sex.
Okay. Lynn, the next question comes from the Stanford Group. Say, Mr. LaRouche, in trying to analyze why certain proposals that we put forward, which we thought were obvious, were rejected, we started to take a closer look at how our policy here in the U.S. is in fact structured. And among the things that we learned is that essentially, over the course of especially the last 30 years, there has been a complete dismantling of effective taxing power over those who sit at the top of the system. The effective corporate tax rate for the top 20 firms in the U.S. is currently under 2%. There's more that could be said about this, but the bottom line is that the effect has been to create a trained professional class of retainers who devote themselves to preserving the existing system. Furthermore, there were massive frauds in the origination of mortgages, in the rating processes that led to securitization, and in the credit default swaps that were supposed to insure against loss. In the policy approach so far, there has been a consistent failure to address, analyze, remedy, and above all, prosecute these frauds. And our insistence that our government would not see any restoration of public trust until this occurred has fallen on deaf ears in Washington. The bottom line is that fundamental reform and any kind of bottom-up recovery strategy of the sort that we've proposed is blocked from the outset. Obama has his equivalent of Lewis Douglas, the conservative budget director under FDR, but there is nobody in Washington, at least, who is prepared to play the roles of Harry Hopkins, Harold Ickes, and Francis Perkins, who were the architects of the New Deal employment policy, of public works, and of improved labor conditions. Meanwhile, major legislation from health care to bank reform continues to be written in consultation with lobbyists. One example is that the legislation on credit default swaps was actually prepared by Jamie Dimon and his lobbyists. The fact, though, is that above all else, what we see as the greatest danger in being able to shape any policy under these current circumstances is that the market has come to substitute for the functions of the state. And without the state, the concept of the public interest disappears from all policy. Markets, by definition, serve private interests. With that said, however, banks are institutions that are chartered by public authority to serve public purpose. It's clearly understood, both in U.S. law and in practice, that banks have responsibilities as well as rights, and that the state has power over the conduct of banks, including the power and the duty to take them over and run them when they're troubled enough to threaten the public guarantee that lies behind bank deposits. Financial markets, on the other hand, especially the shadow banking system that we see today, exist to place in the domain of private market transactions what previously existed in a clearly defined relationship to public purpose. They escape both regulation and insurance, and the result has been to vitiate the concept of public service, creating in banks privileged and power market-oriented institutions that use and largely control the state rather than respond to it. Now, all of us seem to agree that this system needs reform. Even Geithner and Summers have written articles to this effect. But the question is, what changes will actually count as fundamental? We've arrived at the conclusion that there will be no fundamental change unless and until we agree on two basic things. Number one, that laws were broken and that the lawbreakers must be prosecuted. If they are not prosecuted, then there is absolutely nothing that would serve as a deterrent for them to do it all over again. Number two, it is our contention that it must be stated clearly and without compromise that banks are institutions that are chartered by public authority to serve public purpose. They have no other function in the American Republic. We know that this is a position that is going to lead to a tremendous outcry, and we're probably all going to be denounced as a bunch of wild-eyed radicals. But we really don't see any other way to address this, and we'd like your comments on whether or not you think we're in the right direction.
There is a great movement in the United States today, which erupted in the month of August, which I've characterized scientifically as a mass strike. It's clear that over 60% of the American public has arisen in a strike, a protest, against what it hates. First of all, in the person of the President of the United States, and secondly, in most of the members of the Congress and both houses. This is a phenomenon which is poorly understood by most people, but I understand it very well because I've studied my history. This is a genuine mass strike. The most recent example as a precedent for this happened in East Germany in 1989, when the people of the East Germany, especially from Saxony, rose up and said, "Wir sind das Volk. We are the people." And the DDR regime collapsed. And the whole Soviet system went into a process of disintegration. We had a similar event throughout the cities of the United States during the month of August. A true mass strike. Not a protest movement, a mass strike. The characteristic of these things, as I saw the tapes of them, the videotapes of them, the people said, "Shut up. Listen to what we say. We don't want to hear what you have to say. We're telling you." And they're still saying it. Over 60% of the U.S. citizenry despises the current president, but treats him with respect despite despising him because they want to achieve the dignity of exerting their rights as citizens. And the health care issue is the number one issue. Right? So now look at this, all the other issues. When the American citizen rises on his hind legs and says, "We are the people, you..." Which I think a great number of them said, in effect, what I saw on the television shots of this thing. Then you have the exertion of the ultimate power of government under a republic, a true republic. The power does not lie with the majority of the vote. The majority of the vote's not worth anything. You can buy it. As that's the way most of our people got into Congress. They bought the vote. There was no expression, moral expression in this. Oh, there were some hints of this and that. But the vote was bought with money. And the politicians went to people with money and said, "Buy us. Buy us. We'll be yours. Give us the money, we'll buy us, we're for sale,
And that's how this kind of problem arises. But then suddenly, everything is under control. We fixed the election. We got this bum in. This bum is now employing these policies, which we hate. What are we going to do? How do we protest? Do we go to our representatives and ask him to represent us? This prostitute is going to be teach us sex life? No, we say, we are the American people, and you have just made it very plain to us that you are not one of us. You don't represent us. See, this is what the American Revolution was. And, the problem is that people don't understand classical culture at all. They think classical culture is something you study in a university, which they should study in a university, but they really don't. They do the same thing in universities they do in election campaigns. Vote for us, and you get it, you know. I mean, it's mostly fakery. But the essential thing is that there is a phenomenon where a people, and this occurs repeatedly in history, as in the case of the American Revolution, where a people recognizes a sense of a common interest as human beings. As human beings of a certain culture, a certain political culture, or a group of cultures, recognize we are human beings. What's the interest of a human being? What are the rights of a human being? As opposed to some kind of slave or hired servant or something. And where they suddenly get a sense of what is it that we really want? What is the principle, the dynamic that unites us in a common sense of what we really want and should have as a right? The assertion of the natural rights of a people. And this comes in a form that's described by Shelley. I've often referred to Shelley, but he's not the only one. He's just the most best known in the English language. It's a defense of poetry, the concluding part of that. Is that there are periods in history in which the people are seized in large numbers by a certain sense of a common interest, a common moral interest, a common conceptual interest. And at such times, the people find themselves capable of being united in a common purpose by a force which they don't fully understand but whose validity they recognize. And this comes out in this expression of our rights, our mission, our purpose. We're no longer going to be in a slum. We're going to decide to move upward. We decided that it's our right and obligation to do this. And they say, well, if this is the moral principle which should govern us, it is this moral principle that must govern us in suitable form, suitable expressions. And that's how you get these great movements. There is in the United States today, despite the folly of that silly egotist, the president, there is a power which is far greater than anything he and his crowd represent in the United States today. The people of the United States have said, you are a bum. We don't like you. We're going to rip that mustache off from under your nose because you have threatened to kill us, to set the dogs upon us, to kill us by taking away our health care and murdering us in order to save your money. You save the money of the people who bought you, Mr. President, and may decide that they paid too high a price for this purchase of this worthless object. So that's the way things are going now. And therefore, the only way in which you correct this kind of problem is when a people are aroused, as the people of the United States in large numbers manifested this in their turnout in the month of August. They were aroused to a sense of a purpose, a higher purpose, to a higher morality. And then they insist, as the way that the people of Saxony, for example, brought down the DDR regime, where the land of milk and honey was no longer milk and honey, and brought the regime down. You're now in a period where the American people are now desperate. You have seen in the month of August that a representation of a sample of 60% or more of the population despises this present administration. And the members of the Congress have been frightened by this scarecrow and have come in back into office trembling. Well, how am I going to do now? What am I, tomorrow I can, a joint session of the Congress, what am I going to do? He's up there, he's looking at me, he's looking at me. What are we going to do? They're going to find the American people are still of that disposition. And that damn fool better learn real quick what the reality is. The American people are not going to tolerate this. And that is the government. That's the day on which politicians, which are bought and paid for by Wall Street, most of them are bought and paid for by Wall Street. What do they pay for Barney Frank? Whatever it was far too much. His services are not particularly desirable. So that's the reality of this. And what you have to do and what I have to do is we have to be governed by that. We have to be governed by our own conscience, but our own conscience is informed by we are a part of a people. I'm a part of a people. If I'm going to act and act to try to change things, I have to do it with the consent of the people. Huh? And therefore, that the people are speaking. And some people in Washington are not listening. The press is telling them it's not true, but it is true. We are headed for a crisis like humanity has not seen in its memory. About to break out on a global scale. We're about to go into a dark age beyond belief if you try to continue this system. The people say no. They don't want this go into this system. They want out of this system. And they are a power which is greater than any combination of elected representatives. And you try to defy them and you will find that they will speak. Because their very lives, the meaning of their lives, more than their lives itself, is the meaning of their lives that is being disgraced. You're taking these our American people out there. You're taking their lives, you're destroying the meaning of their life. They will lay down their life for the meaning of their life. But they will not lay down the meaning of their life. And you're taking away the meaning of their life. Mr. President, you're a damn fool. I know you're ignorant. But even an ignorant man like you, Mr. President, shouldn't be such a damn fool. I'll try to save your butt.
Okay. Lynn, the next question comes from a representative from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, who has been working with the section of the Stanford group that's working on jobs policy. And he says, Mr. LaRouche, I know you're aware of the fact that unemployment climbed to 9.7% last month and that represents a 26-year high. However, I don't know if you have access to all of the information that we have access to, and I'd like to share some of that with you before I ask my question. He says, certainly, the trend is that we've lost a lot of jobs and we're still losing them. But the fact is that the media has somehow tried to turn this into a good thing, saying that the trend is somehow improving. Trying to put that spin on it is the equivalent of putting lipstick on a pig. Because the bottom line is that for the job situation to be improving, it would mean that we would have to stop losing jobs. The fact is that as bleak as the recent reports seem to be, the fact of the matter is that the situation is really far worse. And there are a couple of things that I think have to be noted. He says, number one, the unemployment numbers of the past 2 months were revised upward to include another 46,000 job losses. We will probably see a lot more of that in the coming months because of this strange thing called the birth-death model, which counts theoretical business births and deaths. That model added 116,000 theoretical jobs last month, which was 26,000 more than it added the month before. I want to stress, however, that these jobs are theoretical. They do not exist. And then there is the question of seasonal adjustment. Note that the number of people no longer counted in the labor force, thus doing their patriotic duty to hold down the unemployment rate, is something that we, again, have to look at, especially in terms of seasonally adjusted numbers. That rose by 143,000. The subset, however, of those still wanting a job rose to 381,000. Now, if you look at the non-seasonally adjusted numbers, you find people no longer counted in the workforce. And that rose 1,578,000. That's an enormous number to ignore. The subset of those still wanting a job rose 516,000. Then you have to look at the number of jobs lost. Our survey showed a plunge of 392,000. At least that was the government number. But that number was flattered by a surge in self-employment. Now, whether these newly minted consultants and home improvement contractors were making any money is wholly another story. And wage and salary workers, well, they don't figure into this equation, but they happen to have plunged by 637,000. That is the largest decline since March, when the stock market was testing its new lows. The number of people not on temporary layoff surged by 220,000 in August, and that level continues to reach new highs. In fact, that number alone is now at 8.1 million. This accounts, by the way, for about 54% of the unemployed. And it's a proxy for permanent job loss. To make the point, these jobs are not coming back. Now, if we think about that for a moment, then we have to consider some other things as well. Today, there are 223,000 fewer jobs in America than there were 10 years ago. But the country has 33.5 million more people. How you can call this anything but a Great Depression is really beyond me. The unemployment rate for adult males is well over 10%, even by official numbers. And for people under the age of 25, it's over 27%, which is the highest on record. The average duration of unemployment is also at the highest level that it has ever been since we started keeping records. The precondition for job gains, which is longer hours for part-timers and taking on additional temporary employees, was not met last month. Now, despite all these depressing numbers, there are two numbers that make it even worse. The first number is 1.3 million. That's the number of people whose unemployment benefits are going to run out by the end of the year. 500,000 of them will exhaust their benefits before this month is over. These people are going to lose yet one more strand of what has become a very thin safety net. Right now, more than 50% of the people who collect unemployment will exhaust their benefits, and they will do it very quickly. Now, workers aren't the only ones who are running out of unemployment money. The states are, too. 18 states have simply run out of money to pay the benefits, and they've been forced to borrow from Washington. In fact, in the last 2 months, they've borrowed more than $8 billion. That number is going to grow as more states reach the brink. Now, if they are not able to pay that amount back before 2011, and most of them will not be able to do so, they are facing paying hundreds of millions of dollars in interest. Many have been maintaining close to zero reserves for years, even before the economy ostensibly headed south. California got into trouble by raising benefits without increasing taxes. Other states like Michigan lowered taxes to levels that were unsustainable for them to run their budgets. Now, in the midst of the worst crisis our nation has ever faced, these states are going to be forced to either raise taxes or cut benefits in the middle of a depression. Just when those changes will do the most economic damage. The second depressing number is 40%, and that's the percentage of people collecting food stamps who are employed. That's up from 25% just 2 years ago. These are people who have watched their hours being cut to the point that they can no longer make ends meet without government assistance. And given the fact that the threshold for collecting food stamps is really quite high, their situation is dire. Yet they are listed as being employed. On top of that, 35% of all workers in the United States have less than 1 week's salary in savings. The job situation in the United States is going to continue to get worse unless the reasons for these job losses are addressed. And despite what President Obama seems to think, the economy did not break down because the American consumer bought too few cars and not enough houses. So the fact is that tax credits to encourage people to buy more cars and houses is not going to solve this problem. The question is, what will it take to solve the problem? And that really is where my question comes in. Not to ask you what it will take, because I believe that you have outlined that both in broad terms and in private communications, more specific terms. My question is this. If I were the president and I was going to go to the American people to ask for their support for a broad recovery program, I would not wish to cover up these numbers. I would want people to know just how bad things were and just how many people in our nation were suffering. The fact that we continually cover this up and minimize the plight of these unemployed, the fact that there is no media in the U.S. that shines a spotlight on this, leads me to believe, and it leads many others to believe, that the government itself has no intention whatsoever of asking for support for policies that would address this. Obviously, this is a very stark contrast to the way FDR approached the problem, but then FDR actually intended to do something about it. Am I being cynical? Or is that, in fact, what the problem is?
Well, that's a characteristic of our problem, is Cheney lied. in his part in getting the United States into the war in Iraq. Cheney lied in many other ways. It was orchestrated lying about 9/11. The story of 9/11 was known. The facts were known. 9/11 was organized by the British government through a certain branch of its government in cooperation with Saudi Arabia and several of the terrorists who were actually involved in terminating themselves in this process were actually paid through funding through the Saudi ambassador to the United States. A Saudi ambassador was very close to the Bush administration. As a matter of fact, the immediate event after the 9/11 event, you had a plane of people who had been in Texas of the Obama, family. And they were moved by plane. The only plane to leave the United States territory in that period was that family. It's no secret. There were indications of that in the hearings, but under the table. Now, what happened? Isn't something done by the friends of the President of the United States, the friends of his family, with the aid of the ambassador to the United States of Saudi Arabia, and funded through an organization which is a branch of British cooperation with the Saudi interests. Why was this covered up? What was the reason? Why was McKinley assassinated? Why was Lincoln assassinated? Why were some of these things done? It's not just the statistical business that's the problem. This is typical of history. The people are fooled. They're panicked. They're herded like sheep. Fear of this and fear of that, and move them into this and move them into that. They become superstitious. I believe there was some mysterious force that did 9/11. It was not a mysterious force. It was a covered operation, but it was not a mysterious force. The evidence is there to this day. It's on the record. The ambassador of Saudi Arabia to the United States was involved in funding and protecting two of the participants in 9/11. The operation was done, we know. Why was it done? Because you had a jerk who couldn't qualify it as a soda jerk as President of the United States, who was not going to be able to govern very well. You look at his popularity about the time he got in. He ran against Al Gore. I mean, that's a setup. There's no one that president could have beaten, except Al Gore. By throwing that Patsy Gore in there, that's really helped the whole process. Anyway, but the point is, it's ungovernable. So what happened was, after a discrete interval of panic, they put in new laws, which became the present system. The present system by which the presidency is governed. And that's how Obama got in. That's what Obama represents. Signing statements. Unitary government. This is dictatorship. It's essentially of the same category as the Hitler dictatorship established, what Hitler stuck in, by what? By the British government. Hitler was appointed to become the dictator of Germany by the British Foreign Office, by the Bank of England. And through the Bank for International Settlements, which had been established in Switzerland as a part of this process. Where Schacht was an asset of the British Bank of England, was transferred to operate out of the Bank of International Settlements. The Bank of International Settlements was the vehicle through which Schacht was brought into Germany for the economic policy.
In the same period, somebody set fire to the Reichstag. And the Reichstagsbrand, which is what I said was expected, something like a Reichstagsbrand. When I looked at this president, Bush, after he's elected, even before he was actually inaugurated, I said, this president is going to bring the United States something like a Reichstagsfire in order to bring a dictatorship here. The Reichstagsfire proved to be 9/11, which instituted a reign of terror, which later resulted in these signing statements and the idea of the integral government, this kind of sovereignty, the shared sovereignty, which is now denounced by Obama when he was running for president, is now his policy. So we're running under a dictatorship in which the powers of the Congress are limited by the imposition of this signing statement procedure, of this integrated government. That's how these things are done. You've got to look. Don't look for whose hand was in the pocket as such. Look for who benefited. What was the result? And that's our situation today. We are under a high degree of fakery in government. And if we are fools enough to accept that, then I tell you that humanity, we'll just put it this way. What's going to happen to humanity if we don't change this? What happens if things go the way Obama says? Well, you can kiss the country goodbye. It'll be gone soon. Matter of fact, every country in the world will be gone soon. Because if the United States goes down, if the United States dollar collapses, I can assure you that every government of the world, every nation of the world, will go through a collapse in rapid fire sequence as a result. That you will have probably for a couple of generations or more, you'll have a vast collapse of population until finally the present policy of the British monarchy to reduce the world population to less than 2 billion people from present 6.7 will be achieved. Most languages will have disappeared. Most cultures will have disappeared. But they'll get what they want in the end. They'll get a system of oligarchy that they want, if we're fools enough to let them. And the problem here is that we tend to be on two levels fools. And as the questioner put it, on the one level, we allow ourselves to be fooled on this kind of thing, which is the more immediate thing. But we don't ask ourselves the deeper question, why is this done? To what end is this foolery done? Just to fool us? Well, let's look at what's happening tomorrow. What the hell is going on when a brainless president of the United States can order an appearance of the Congress before both sessions to hear him give orders? What do you think that means? What's happened to our separation of powers? What's happened to checks and balances? This is a step toward tyranny. And the only thing in the way is a few voices like me, but more important, a mass strike movement of over 60% of the U.S. population. And be careful that you don't overlook what I say, because I don't have any contract with those people out there, that 60% that wants this presidency changed, but I know how to read their intentions. And I'm telling you, I'm not the prophet Isaiah, but I'm telling you, you do on this, you are people out there, you do what you have to do, as I've said today, or you're not going to have a country. And worse, you're not going to have a civilization. Because I know exactly what this is leading toward. It's up to those of us in the United States who have the knowledge and guts to tell this president, you get in your office, and we'll tell you what to do. You're going to stop this nonsense, and you're going to fire these characters. You're going to drop this health care nonsense. and you're going to announce that you have now changed your policy. You're now going for a mass increase in productive employment policy.
Lynn, I'm going to veer slightly away from some of the questions on economy to address a question that was submitted by a well-known historian and author from the East Coast. But it also, I'm going to kind of make it a composite question because we have gotten so many questions in on this particular issue. And he says, Mr. LaRouche, one of the things that I fear most in the immediate weeks ahead is the social ramifications or constitutional ramifications, if you will, of the course that I see this president taking. First, on the question of health care, it seems increasingly to be the consensus that this administration, aside from the fact that they've proposed a monstrous policy that nobody really seems able to support, that they are determined to get it through. And they have talked openly of the use of the parliamentary technique of reconciliation to force a yes vote on their health care reform package. If they do this, the likely result will be an explosion both in the Congress and among the American people. Secondarily, President Obama has made clear and has stated explicitly that he need not obey laws as written. This is the echo of the Bush signing statements. He has identified many areas where he need not comply with the law as written. But one of the key areas of this is the question of restrictions on putting troops under UN command and placing troops. There is a simmering situation in the U.S. around the question of the increase of troops in Afghanistan. People read these headlines with dread, and this has only been overshadowed by the debate on health care. But the fact of the matter is that we have never had any debate on what U.S. policy toward Afghanistan would be. Yet even so, it does indeed appear that this president is going to commit more troops and that this president is going to broaden the war effort in Afghanistan. Again, I fear that if he does this, and I believe that he will, that this will lead to a complete explosion, both among liberals and progressives, but also among certain layers of the Republican Party. Now, you are forewarning of a crisis of unprecedented proportions as we enter the final phase of the breakdown of this financial system. Under these conditions, to have a president who takes steps like these, steps that do not gain the confidence and trust of the American people, but in fact undermine it, really does worry me. This is no time for us to have a constitutional crisis. Yet, every sign would tend to indicate that this is the way we are proceeding. My question to you may be somewhat rhetorical, but this president seems to be obsessed with his standing and with his popularity. Isn't there some way that this can be leveraged so that he will cut out this kind of insane behavior. He is undermining his ability to govern in a crisis, and that crisis is clearly at our doorstep. Would you please comment?
Well, if it becomes a test between the survival of the United States and the incumbency of this president, guess which way I vote. It's that simple. I mean, we're in real history now. People have studied anecdotal history for so long that they don't know real history because they don't understand it. They think of it in statistical terms or narrative terms. They don't understand the pulsations which underlie the surface of the behavior of humanity. They don't understand human beings. They don't understand human culture, really. And this has become worse because we've come at a time where classical culture disappeared, was outlawed at the end of World War II by Truman and company, by Churchill and company. You know, the point which I make extensively in this latest publication, which I've completed, is the essential thing that differentiates a human being from an animal is not mathematics. I think we could train an ape to do most of the kinds of mathematics that I've run into these days. The distinction of a human being is the creative powers of human being, which lie in classical artistic composition. This is particularly true in the case, when you look at the case of classical musical composition, classical poetry, and scientific creativity. I often use the case of Albert Einstein and the relationship of his violin to his creativity in mathematical physics. The essence of creativity lies in a quality which is called inspiration, not mathematics. A mathematician is a stupid person, as long as they remain a mathematician. But it's only when they take the organization of the material before their consideration and are inspired to see something beyond that as being an efficient force, an efficient characteristic of this, that you get what we call creativity, the effect of creativity, including scientific creativity. And the problem here is that we lose sight of that. We lose sight of the role of creativity or the moods which are associated with creativity in a population. This is the way a dynamics works. So it's what Shelley is describing in his A Defense of Poetry. Is that there's a power which is specifically human, specific to human beings, a power of dynamics, of the superiority of dynamics in the character of the human being. And the human being operates on the basis of the imagination, but does not trust the imagination as such, but tests the imagination against what is feasible in reality. That's creativity. And from that we discuss principles which underlie, like the principle of the distinction between non-living beings and living ones, the qualitative distinction between human beings and animals or other forms of life. And these are three principles: the non-living, the living, and the human, the cognitive. Three universal principles that we know. And within that framework, we challenge our own powers of imagination, as Einstein did, with long sessions with his violin. He was a gifted amateur violinist. And when it was struck by the imagination with a concept to say, is this feasible, then he went back to the laboratory to think it out and work it out. And from the experience of testing the powers of the imagination against reality is where creativity occurs. And this occurs in all good people who think that way, but it occurs especially in the people at large when they're sufficiently challenged. When they say, isn't there something better than this? Isn't this wrong? And then in their imagination they try to imagine the alternative.
to see what's wrong, to imagine what could cause this. Why could I behave so stupidly? Why did I make that stupid mistake? Why did so-and-so make that stupid mistake? Why did we elect that jerk? And it's in those kinds of inspiration by the powers of the imagination, as disciplined and tested against experimental reality, that we get out of these kinds of messes. We're at a point now where the American people, those who are the over 60% who have certified that they want this president and this Congress out. I would say that about 80% of the members of Congress today are ready for the chop in the next available election as it stands today. They want no part of it. They've made it very clear. And they've terrified the Congress out there in the month of August by just this fact. They don't want these guys anymore. They stink. They're traitors. They can't be trusted. You vote for them and they go out and they vote against you. They betray you every time and say we had to kiss the butt of the president or something like that, which is a terrible idea. And that's where the problem lies. And the solution lies. The solution lies we are going to have to do what we have to do. But what we're going to do is what we're going to do in the imagination first. And we're going to test the fruits of the imagination against the reality. And we're going to look at our neighbors and friends, and we're going to say, this was my imagination. Am I crazy or am I right? And the friends, if they say yes, they're going to go to the next guy. Is this just us or are we right? And so on. And that process radiates through the population very rapidly. And out of this, very sudden changes and sweeping changes have occurred often in human history, sometimes not often enough. But it's not for me to decide. It's for me, my authority is extended to what I know is the present state of affairs. And at that, I'm fairly confident, particularly the competition is rather poor these days. On the other hand, what I should do is limited by my perception of what the American people in particular are disposed to do. And what I think and what they think the consequences of doing that might be. So I don't go too far. I tell this president, okay, you bum, get in your office and take a few lessons from me and we'll work something out for you. So you stay in office and we don't have to put the nation through an impeachment process. However, if you don't go along with this, I can say that we're going to head toward the inevitability of a very nasty impeachment process, and very soon. Mr. President, you have a few days to decide, because I think that when the month of August reaches, and when all the bankrupt states of the 50 states of the nation are arranged, and there's no means to pay, and the nation states are collapsing in their economy. The national credit is collapsing, and a chain reaction collapses extended throughout the planet, and the planet is going into chaos before, as a Christmas tree gift. Then I think something will happen. And I think the disposition will be, get that guy out of here. And take about 80% of the Congress with him.
Okay, before I go back to some of the economic questions, we have been deluged with questions, both institutional questions and questions from individuals. On the current swine flu situation,
and I'm going to read two brief questions because I think they both capture the essence of what all these people are asking. One is just from an ordinary citizen who says, "Mr. LaRouche, my wife has just received a letter from her employer, Columbia Memorial Hospital in Hudson, New York. It says that all hospital employees must submit to a flu vaccination, and that if they do not, they will not be permitted to work after November 30th, 2009. It says that they are just following orders from the Department of Health, although they do not say whose Department of Health, federal, state, county, city. They also begin vaccination on September 9th, but the swine flu vaccinations are not being sent out until October. So we wonder what they are injecting us with, should she refuse to take this vaccine. Before I read the next question, let me just, as a point of information, make clear that while it's true that the swine flu vaccine is not going to be available until October, most health departments are, I think, properly instructing people to be vaccinated now with a seasonal flu vaccine to provide them with some protection, and then later on to get swine flu vaccines when they become available. There is a growing movement, particularly among African Americans, saying that they are going to resist the vaccinations because they believe that it's an avenue of genocide. I will say, and I haven't discussed this with Lynn, but I will say as a public health professional that I agree with Department of Health recommendations, that particularly, for in this case, where you're talking about a public health worker, that people who have not been vaccinated should not be permitted to work in these fields. And that is just a very basic public health measure. The next question along the same lines has come from three different journalists, two of them outside the United States, one of them from inside the United States, and the one from inside the United States is from a major African-American newspaper. And they say, Mr. LaRouche, have you considered the possibility, as many analysts and whistleblowers seem to believe, that the so-called swine flu pandemic could have originated from a private or government lab and could be part of an agenda of population control under the World Health Organization and other global organizations' umbrella, coinciding precisely with the expected financial collapse of middle October?
Well, that's too simplistic. Of course such things are possible. But what do you do in such a case? Is there anything different to the way you would do it before or afterward, one way or the other? If the thing is being spread, do you take the antidote? The thing is being spread willfully, but it's just occurring, do you take the antidote? So see what's been happening? The public is being played by this kind of thing, to induce into a state of paranoia, saying, should I take it? Is it really they're trying to poison me? Or should I take it? Maybe they're trying to frighten me not into taking it so I will die. What are they trying to do to me? Well, how do you judge a question like that? First of all, you say, wait a minute, buddy, who's they? Who's them? Is it the U.S. government? Well, you should suspect the worst, at least these days. No, it's don't get into this kind of thing. You have to operate, in this kind of situation, you have to operate on the best option you have. And the assumption if the disease is out there, and the disease is known to be out there, there's no question about that. That's very clearly established. Then you better find the antidote real quick and don't fool around about it. Don't worry about it. I think the thing was spread, the rumor was spread that this was done as a synthetic operation. It's done in order to actually spread the disease. If people don't take the vaccine, what will happen? The disease will spread. And more people will die, including those who refuse to take the vaccine, especially. So that's the kind of question you have. So in a case like this, don't let your paranoia rule. You've got enough paranoia in the presence of the president himself. He's got enough paranoia for all of us. We don't need any more. Forget it.
Lynn, this question comes from someone who serves as the economist for the National Governors Association. And he says, Mr. LaRouche, as I'm sure you know, most state constitutions require balanced budgets. So in a depression, or a recession if you prefer, when revenues fall, states are compelled to behave perversely. They cut program outlays just when public needs increase the most. They lay off workers, they defer projects, they raise taxes, and they resort to budget gimmicks that are bad policy in their own right. This has led to a situation where governors who are facing election campaigns in the next election cycle, be they Democrats or Republicans, are being faced with defeat at the polls because of policies that they are being forced to implement. What we are calling for, and I am asking you if you would support this, but what we are calling for is an emergency federal intervention in the form of aid to the states. Some would argue that the idea is radical, that it would add to the federal deficit, but my argument is that the idea is about as radical as Richard Nixon was, because he was the first person who proposed general revenue sharing back in 1970. This approach requires no advanced planning. It simply will prevent deeper cuts. Our proposal is that the federal government simply write 50 checks, one for each state. Participating states would have to commit to maintenance of effort, i.e., maintaining their taxing and spending policies as of some particular date, say January 1st, 2009, or December 2008, whatever is agreed upon. The tonic effect of this approach is almost instantaneous, since cuts and layoffs are prevented, suspended projects and programs are resumed, and laid-off workers are recalled. The fact is that if we don't do this, the current carnage that each state faces will worsen. All but two states face budget shortfalls for this fiscal year, and the shortfalls are enormous. The fact is that the Obama stimulus package doesn't come close to even replacing 25% of that shortfall. The fact is that if what we are proposing is in fact implemented, some can argue that the primary benefits would be macroeconomic, saving jobs, preventing program cuts, and making sure that states don't worsen consumer purchasing power by regressively raising taxes in a depression. But there's also a secondary benefit in preventing a further erosion of trust in government. When state budgets go into free fall and localities slash services that people both need and expect, the results are catastrophic. Schools and libraries close, government offices cut hours, community college budgets take hits, and the most creative and valued programs are more often than not the first to go. As public employees are laid off, government's basic capacity to do its job is wrecked. Just as an example, 21 states have cut low-income health insurance or reduced access to health care. 22 states in the District of Columbia are cutting medical, rehabilitative, and home care services for low-income people who are elderly or disabled. At least 24 states are cutting or proposing to cut funds for kindergarten to grade 12 schooling, early education, and child care. And 32 states have already cut support for public colleges and universities. Another example, in Alabama, in Birmingham, Alabama, the municipal government was forced to fire cafeteria workers at the local jails. They did it. They saved money. But they don't have any idea how they're going to feed the inmates. Secondarily, it has come to our attention that the city of Birmingham no longer has the necessary funds to bury its indigent, and therefore the bodies are piling up. The strategy of emergency revenue sharing would seem to be low-hanging fruit for the Obama administration. It's a great bipartisan remedy. Republican governors and legislators support it, as well as Democrats. I'm even willing to take the suggestion of one Washington, D.C. journalist that we name the bill for Richard Nixon. But I'm wondering if you would lend your support to such an effort.
No, I would not lend my support to it at all, and because it's a waste of time. It's actually avoiding the issue by going to an elaborate around the bend, what if, what if, what if, what if, what if. This is nonsense. We have the thing that's going to decide entirely from the top down the future of this nation is what is done about this presidency. Don't talk to me about these other things. You're wasting your time. You don't have a chance unless you do something about this presidency. That's the issue. This guy either shapes up, as I have proposed, to help the poor slob under protection, or we lose the nation. Who cares about these so-called alternatives? What if the president doesn't do something? What if the president fails? What are we going to do then? You're going to die. And therefore, you're going to do what you have to do about this presidential system now. Because if you don't do it, there's nothing else you can do. You're doomed. Therefore, you better learn. As most of the 80% of the people out there protesting against this presidency have said, and against stupid congressmen who want to go along with him have said, you either change this or you're finished. We are not going any. We can't go any further. We're on the edge of doom. Don't talk about alternatives. There are no alternatives. You either change this presidency and this policy or you don't have a nation. So don't tell me and ask me what we're going to do about it if the presidency is not fixed. You're not going to do a damn thing about it. Because the world's going into the deepest crisis you ever saw. Every other suggestion is a damn waste of time.
Okay, I am going to ask Lynn to answer two more questions. One is another question on this issue of policy, and the other is a different kind of question. This question comes from a fairly well-known economist and author who also is working with this Stanford group. He says, Mr. LaRouche, 25 years ago, I was part of a debate on industrial policy. And it's old news that I was on the losing side. Neither Democratic presidents nor Republican ones accepted the idea that it mattered whether the United States had world-class industries. After all, we were told, we were becoming a service economy, and services were just as good as products. Most economists ridiculed industrial policy on the grounds that government was not competent to pick winners and that free markets would make the appropriate investment. Well, a quarter of a century later, most of those services have turned out to be financial services, and a lot of that sector turned out to be a big bubble, which has popped. The free market has made one blunder after another, And ever since the financial collapse began in earnest in the spring of 2007, government has been picking winners with taxpayer money, except that most of them are failing banks. A reading of American history reveals that the U.S. has had industrial policies all along, and it began with Alexander Hamilton's report on manufacturers. It continued into World War II and proceeded through the space program of John F. Kennedy. Government investment in biotech is another example. All of this, from Alexander Hamilton to John Kennedy, represents one big industrial policy. Go back and read books from the debate that I was part of. Blackstone and Harrison, The Deindustrialization of America. Steve Cohn and John Zeisman's Manufacturing Matters. You look at them today and they look prophetic. We all, including you, Mr. LaRouche, lost the political argument back then, but we were right all along. Now, with the economy facing a prolonged crisis, the fact is that unless we address this directly, then I do not see how we can find any way out. It's not just about banking policy or financial policy. It has to be about what it is we intend to do for our nation and for the world.
Fun one. This is a nice question because it prompts me to put on the table what I think are. We said a lot of things here today, and I've said a lot of things earlier, but this is quite to the point. You know, the last lame effort of the United States to save its soul came when John F. Kennedy made a speech about doing something that was good to do because it was hard, the space program, the moon landing program. We have now, see, at that point, you had a division in the economy. To the extent that the space program, as Kennedy had actually revived it from near death, it was about to die. But he revived it by that speech. And despite the other things that intervened during the period up to the time that this crazy Nixon came in. But we actually, in the space program, had the most important accomplishments in economy, in our existence, occurred within this sector of the economy during that period. We reached the ironical point, however, with 1967-68, with a change in the budget under those conditions, in which we were sending things into space, as to the moon, but we were using up the technology which had brought us there. That is, we had lost many of the technologies which had been developed in the, under the space program earlier. This was the same thing that hit the Route 128 circuit in Massachusetts about that time, where all these satellite industries around MIT and so forth were involved in various branches of the space program. And they began to collapse. But their product went into space, leaving the thing that had produced this product behind. And you will find there's still today bits of technology kicking around in some private laboratory here or there, where it left in a dustbin from that period, and it's still around. Now, don't talk about economy the way most people talk about economists. And people who are decent economists really don't believe much in what's called economics today. They think actually in terms of much more concrete terms. And they don't use terms like industrial economy in any different sense than the distinction that Alexander Hamilton made with manufacturers back in that time. Infrastructure, agriculture, manufacturers, those are still the basic categories. Everything else is subsidiary. Now, the key thing that drives is science, physical science in particular. And physical science has many manifestations.
that has the process of discovery, the process leading to a process of a discovery, and the spillovers of a process as the effects of the discovery come trickling down through the process of engineering and so forth down the line. And what happens is we go essentially, the main line is an increase in the energy flux density of the sources of power employed and deployed. In other words, the transition from burning of coal to coke to petroleum and natural gas, then to nuclear power, the organization of electrical power, the changes in the uses and form of electrical power, for example, the development of the alternating current motor in New York City at the beginning of the 20th century was a change in the use of electricity which made possible the smaller independent machine which would operate the particular process in the production line. This was a revolution in productivity in the United States which hit about 1910, 1911, 1912. So you have various revolutions of this type in technology which break through and spill over into the industrial area, as in the New York area, where this introduction of these large steam-driven factories with belt-driven machines, and now you had the electrical machine, you had the individually powered machine under alternating current. And this was a big revolution at that time. It made possible, the whole machine tool industry was revolutionized over this period by result of this type of thing. So now you're always looking for revolutions, scientific revolutions in technology. And sometimes these are little, like the thing by alternating current improvement, and sometimes there are much more fundamental things. But always in every case, when mankind adopts a mission which says, look, we've been doing this for a long time. Isn't there a better way of doing it? And you put a science driver behind this thing. Can anybody come up with a better way? Look at this thing. We've been doing the same thing for 10 years now. Isn't it about time we came up with something new, something fresh? And if you have a project which is a national mission orientation, in all the great movements in history, economic history, come essentially from these revolutions, agro-industrial revolutions, revolutions in technology, mobilizations of people around technology. And it also goes to the question of how far can you go with a given technology? There are limits to any technology. These are the scientific principle limits of technology. Now we have before us a great change. The space program was part of it. We got to the moon, and after Nixon, we could never get to the moon again. He killed the moon. He gave us moonshine instead of moon. And we killed the space program. The space program is a shattered piece of crap today, in which you have elements of scattered in various parts of industry. Some guys have got a laboratory here, somebody's got something there. So the kind of thing we're dealing with now from the basement now. We have before us the prospect of industrialization of the moon, which was devised in the 1970s and early 1980s by a friend of mine, a friend of ours at the time. And that's still valid. Now, if you want to go further into space, you want to go to higher levels of technology on Earth, you have to go into space. Because you have to have the challenge of going into space to get you to drive your technology upward and bring the benefits of driving it upward back to Earth and back to the benefits of mankind. We have also the question of exhaustion of various types of resources. They're not really the resources that are exhausted, it's the way in which they're concentrated. The richest resources are being drawn down. We have to use poorer quality of resources, but we get the same effect. We do that by technological progress. Now the project before us is, and everybody who knows anything about science or economy knows this,
we have to have a project of completing the moon assignment, as which was what the push was then with Kennedy. It was not just going to the moon. The purpose was to industrialize the moon. And these would be largely automatic industries, which required automatic technologies. It would be industries controlled from Earth with very few people because, you know, a low gravitational, electromagnetic gravitational field is not the best thing for your health. And then the object is, what are we going to do with that? Well, we're going to go to Mars. And what the way, how would you go to Mars? Well, if you want to send something to Mars by inertial trajectory, you can do that. But I'd hate to send a human being out on inertial trajectory for 200 to 300 days on a journey between the moon and Mars. It's not exactly, you know, what's going to arrive there? Mr. Blob? So therefore, we have to think about accelerated flight. Well, we have on the moon a resource we recognize, helium-3. The sun has been depositing helium-3 as a mineral on the planet surface of the moon for a long time. There's a big pits of ore of helium-3. Helium-3 happens to be a very useful item for space flight because it can be very directly applied to the propulsion process. We could technically, with helium-3 fusion, we could have a one gravity flight from the orbit of the moon to the orbit of Mars, which would get you between the two planets within a few days. Now, there's some problems to be considered in venturing that, but if we can get to the planet from moon to Mars in several days by 1G gravitation or something comparable to that, that place is open to us, buddy. And whatever resources it has and whatever it means in the stepping stone to further things in space are now available to us. And once we adopt that policy, everything we've done in getting to Mars or getting to Mars now spills back on the planet as a revolution in everything we do on Earth. And the problems and challenges we face solve that. What this country needs, apart from reorganizing this economy in a sensible direction, we need to have, and there are a lot of people about interested in this. We've got 10 nations now which are committed to a moon development project. 10 nations so far committed actively. And I'm committed to a Mars arrival project. I've been committed to this for a long time, as some people know, since I did this half-hour film on Mission to Mars back in 1988, the 88 campaign. And it's still valid today. I don't think I'm going to get there. I think I'm not in the best physical condition for that kind of travel this time. I wouldn't. It's not my sightseeing venture of the year, you know. But anyway, probably in 20, 30, 40 years, we could have achieved not only the fulfillment of the moon development, but will have achieved in some way or the other, we will deal with Mars, we will conquer Mars, we will see what's up there, we'll see what use we make of it, and we will change the nature of man's conception of himself. Man will no longer think of himself as an earthbound land grubber. Not land lumber, but land grubber. And man will think of himself as man in the solar system. Because man is... Now, this means a change of relationships of human beings to human beings. You've got a human being on Mars who's working up there, a human being on Earth. It's a weekend travel to get up there and back and so forth. It's going to change the relationship in human life. All the technologies which are now used to do this will now be reflected in revolutions in technology back on Earth, including growing foodstuff. I mean, growing vegetables on Mars. I mean, this is a real change in agriculture. It broadens your conception of what agriculture means. And the way, that's how you do it. You have to adopt a national mission. The first national mission before us is to get this meathead in the White House and put him under suitable supervision with his consent, of course. He has to consent, but the consent will have to be induced. by rather strong inducements. And the guy will survive. We'll protect him so the British don't kill him, because it's one of their disappointments. They like to blow up things that don't work for them. And that will give us, but we've got to think beyond that. Because I've got people who are now in their 20s. Believe it or not, we still have produced babies. We still have people in their 20s. So we have a supply of them. Now they have, if we can get a bomb under control, they have a life expectancy that goes into their 70s and 80s. And what are they going to do in the meantime? They're going to be the recipients and transmitters of this technological progress and what goes beyond before it, beyond it. And so we have to think about two or three generations ahead. I mean, don't you think about your grandchildren? Don't you think about even your great-grandchildren, if you're lucky? Isn't that your mission in life? Isn't that your sense of continuity in life? So what's that? Generation, 25 years. Three generations, 75 years. Four generations, 100 years. What are you going to be doing in the next 100 years, people? If you're thinking about the future, if you care about your children and grandchildren that are coming after you, if you think about future humanity and locate your identity in what you're doing for them to make their lives possible, what do you think about? You think about where we're going to be 75, 100 years from now. And think how well how accurately we can forecast where we might be. What are our options? Where are we going? What we should be doing? Hey, what are you going to do when you reach your retirement age at age 75 or something, or 70 or 85 with improved health care? What are you going to be doing with yourself? What's your future? What kind of a world are you choosing? What kind of a solar system are you choosing to live in? And that's the way you do it. You don't do it by coming out with a list of this, a list of that. What are your priorities? You go out with a mission for humanity. This is not about jobs. This is not about income. This is about humanity. The difference between man and a beast. What are you as a human being going to do that certifies you're a human being and not shameful in the result in the eyes of your grandchildren? What are you going to accomplish with your life? We accomplished something. We got so far. How far are you going to take us? How much further are you going to take the human race? And that's what makes it work. It's motivation. How you choose to spend your life. Not pass it, but spend it. Expend it. To what purpose? To what end? What are you going to raise children for? To what end? For humanity. Why should you be remembered by people two generations from now? Why should you be respected a generation from now? What are you going to do to earn that respect? Your identity as a human being. And if you follow that line of thinking and use the space issue, space exploration as a parameter, a paradigm from our recent experience, which shows the difference, then you say, we don't talk about industrial policy as such. We don't talk about agricultural policy. We talk about human policy. We talk about the development and progress of the human species to a better life for future generations. And that takes scientific and technological progress, as well as the cultural progress which fosters creativity in the individual human mind. That's our mission. What we're getting is people come with these crazy categories of values, crazy, stupid, dull. They bore me. Now let's talk about going to the moon. That doesn't bore me. Because that involves exactly what we have to do step by step in terms of science and technology to do each thing we have to do to get each step along the way. And that's our mission orientation. We take that mission orientation and you find it works just fine. We've just got to get this thing together a bit. Mr. President, you've got to change your ways, but it'll be good for you. You'll get a good reputation in the future. Just change your ways. Boy, I tell you, I guarantee you, you'll have a successful future. You just change your ways. Just a little bit. It won't be painful. You'll be in the Oval Office. You'll be comfortable. You'll be protected with great zeal. You'll have the privilege of being honored for what your office has done, what the presidency has done. Look at all the good things you get. Instead of being spit upon as you're being spit upon today, Mr. President, it's a much better future for you. Don't you think? I don't think you're going to go to Mars. I don't think you want to go to Mars. Maybe the people over there won't like you. But anyway. But in that case, in any case, that's the way we define a perspective, not in terms of these technicalities of industrial policy or something like that. If you can't spark the imagination and passion of people to accomplish something in the future, you're not going to get to, you're not going to get to the future.
Okay, before I ask the last question, I apologize to all of you who submitted good questions that I didn't get to ask. To those of you who submitted crazy questions, I'm not apologizing. You need to go home and do your homework. But really, we had far more questions institutionally from people here and from people around the world that I had any hope of getting to. And I do hope you'll forgive us for that. Although Lynn did cover a great deal of what people were asking in the body of his opening remarks and also in his answers to other questions. This last question, though, is, I think it's an interesting one. I'd like the answer to it myself. This is from a, it's from one of the leaders of the Stanford group and someone who I've especially worked very closely with over the course of the last months. And the question is, Mr. LaRouche, you've well established your authority on questions of both economic forecasting and planning. Now, especially in these times, it doesn't really take a genius to figure out that the repeal of Glass-Steagall was a mistake and that we ought to look back at FDR for some hot pointers on how to build our way out of a depression. However, anybody who digs deeper into your writings will soon discover that your economic theories are built on a foundation of an in-depth understanding of not only history, which is not so uncommon in our field, but also on theoretical physics, on mathematics, on music, and on other areas of science. Add to that a sense of humor that clearly grows raunchier as the crisis deepens. And, well, all in all, it sets the bar pretty high for the rest of us. In fact, it has left some of us feeling rather inadequate. For some others who have too much of a self-love issue going on to feel inadequate, well, it just seems to piss them off. Anyway, our question really is, how do you manage it all? What's your secret? And what the hell do you eat for breakfast?
I think the secrets are expressed largely in what I write. When I always feel the more I write, the more I have to write, because I realize in writing something, I've left so many things out that I've got a bigger agenda after completing a work than I had before starting it. Because the work itself just carries us. It's questions. And also, the best thing you can do, which I've insisted upon, is don't get stuck in your own generation. You have to look at the coming generations. You have to look at the past, of course, to understand the present. But you have to look at your own generation as just that, and you have to look at the other generations which are coming up. As I look at this, you know, and I have, especially in the recent 10 years or so, actually, more than that now, but since the end of the Clinton administration, one looked more and more at this question about young people coming up, because I was faced with the problem of the baby boomer generation and its influence. Now, the baby boomer generation has two aspects. One is it's a generation, and that's not necessarily good or bad. But it was dominated, especially since a certain group, go back to the end of the war, World War II. I came back from military service abroad in the spring of 1946, and the disaster had already happened. And I had made a statement which I thought later was somewhat prophetic, that a number of soldiers came to me in India in 1945, on April 13th, and I said, wanted to talk to me later that evening. We could do that aside. I said, yes. So they asked me a question which did not in its nature surprise me at the time. What is going to happen to us now that President Roosevelt has died? And I thought, and the answer came to me, the very simple one. We have lived under a great president. We are now faced with a very little man as president. And I'm afraid for us on that account. I was right. And that's then we went into a period which is evil. In Europe, it took the form of the influence of the Congress for Cultural Freedom, which is a Nazi-type organization, which I ran into, and hates me, and I hated them, and the existentialist movement as in the United States and abroad. We also went into a security situation under which we created a category of people of my generation coming back from war who had gotten jobs either through completing university education or going some way into the security area, what became the national security area, and which was pretty much a brainwashing area. And so you had people who were eager to keep their jobs, lest the FBI get some bad information about them. And they raised their children accordingly and tended to flee into communities where people of their own type circulated. They met with only people of their own national security cleared types in these communities. They'd raise children. That's the baby boomer generation. They raised children, and they told these children not to have any definite ideas, to be very careful about who they associated with, and so forth. And then came 1957, a recession. And the arrogance of this generation, which had raised these children, or was raising them, the arrogance went under. They became frightened. Frightened not by the security clearance question, fear of losing their position, their economic position. By 58, it was well defended. I was then an executive in a consulting firm. And people were wandering the streets and coming up to my office begging for jobs at one quarter of the pay which they had received from where they'd come from. And so the children of this we're better than shit layer, raised in these families, underwent an experience. In the meantime, there was a change in culture, especially in Europe and in the United States, away from classical culture. Now, if you know that classical culture is the spark of creativity, including scientific creativity, as typified by the case of Albert Einstein's violin. It's classical culture, which is the power of the imagination as applied to the questions of physical science, which is the source of the inspiration of creativity in physical science. It took that away. So then these people went on to universities. They tended to get into the so-called best universities, the Ivy League universities, and similar types, comparable types. They were the kings of the universe. Oh, we are the perfect people. But they still had an existential fear that they would lose jobs, lose their security, as a family had.
or had been in danger of losing. They went to the best universities. But they felt like an elite, because when the Vietnam War came on, they were able to manage not to get into military service by being in universities, therefore exempt from the draft, until the exemptions got pared down as we approached 1968. And they were conditioned culturally to an existentialist world outlook. And even if they studied sciences, they weren't any damn good at it, because they had an existentialist attitude, which is not good for your creativity. And then came 1968. And then came the change in 1968 after May 1st, with the first step of the collapse of the U.S. monetary system. And they went ape. Really ape. Now, this generation of baby boomers became a nightmare. They became promoted. They took their clothes off. They took everything off. They did all kinds of things. They took all the drugs they were to take. And they got the best positions of influence in society, especially during the Carter administration period and thereafter. And so as the older generation, my generation, began to go into retirement age, these young whippersnappers, so-called, took over and brought their degeneration and their anti-science attitudes with them. And then with 1987, we had a deep recession, one of the deepest in our history as a recession. Panic. We went into absolute insanity in terms of our economic policy. And this generation, the baby boomer generation, is now in the top position. These were the years of George Bush, George H.W. Bush, and Bill Clinton. The worst years in terms of the turn down. 1970, spring 1970, the illusion was over. Or not better than 1990, the illusion was over. 2000, 2001, the end. Then the Bushes. So we've gone through, at that point, in the end of the 1990s, I was very much concerned about what about a new generation? Because what had happened is the baby boomer generation, that is, those who were born in that period after 1945, 46, were not all of the one type, but you had the worst of them were in the top positions. And the effect on a population is if the very worst representatives of a generation is dominant, it has an effect on the attitudes in life of others. And when people get older, when they get past their 40s and 50s, they tend to become frightened if conditions are not favorable. And if they find the top generation, which is apparently successful in setting, controlling society, leading society, is dominant, they will tend to adapt and try to imitate those who they think are more successful. So you had an ideology of a very small part of the population, like the Mark Rudds and similar trash, had risen into top positions of social influence in society, their generation. But the acceptance of the green tendency, the anti-nuclear tendency, the anti-industrial tendency, had become a dominant tendency within this population as a whole, through this structure. And therefore, being a person as I am, I said, well, where's the next, get me the next generation. That happened about 79, going into 80, in that generation. So that's 2001, that period. So I suddenly looked into, as my presidential campaign that year, looked into some of the campuses and began to make contact with people on campuses who were truly of a new generation. They had problems that their president had not had, different circumstances and new problems. But they were
a generation which is capable of providing a succession to this trashy aspect of the ruling generation. And I was more and more committed to that, saying we have to save the population as a whole, we have to save civilization as a whole. But what are you going to do it with? You have to reach out to a generation which is not so deeply demoralized as the baby boomer age generation had become demoralized. And only through their action are you going to get the kick in the rear end, which brings even some of the older guys of the baby boomer generation back into reality. And that's exactly what's happened. But I lived my whole life with this kind of view. I live in history. I go back to about 6,000 years in terms of my fascination in history. And so I look at mankind in that way. I look at mankind as a history of mankind, the development of mankind, the issues of mankind, the problems of mankind. And look at it always from a standpoint of creativity, that mankind is characterized by creativity which no animal has. And it's the role of creativity, human individual creativity, as it expressed in classical artistic composition, and as spills over from classical artistic composition into physical science, as we know physical science from the time of the Pythagoreans and Plato and so forth, which is all one mass to me. And that's what I live in. I live in a devotion to what I think are the treasures of mankind, or the categorical treasures of mankind, and the defense and promotion of what I consider the treasures of mankind. I like to look across at other cultures and find it in other cultures. I particularly like to find it in our own culture, our own European culture, and discover more deeply the secrets of our own culture, of its achievement, and bring them forth. And that's what I write about. That's who I am. I am not a careerist. I have no career. I'm just a person who I am, who is tumbling through experience of life and expressing things that I think are important, as today.
That brings today's event to a close. I would ask you to join me in wishing Lynn a very happy birthday.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you. Have fun.